Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome one and all to Trisha's True Crime Radio. Now what we need to do is get the goo out of the way, the legal goo that is. The opinions expressed on this show are those of the hosts and guests. Trisha's True Crime Radio is a completely separate entity from WebSleuths.com, LLC, and ForumsForJustice.org. So if you get upset at something you hear on this show, my angels, don't take it out on the forums. You take it out on yours truly. We'll make you happy again. Tonight, we have a jam-packed show. Later, we will welcome Tom North. Now, Tom's family was the family featured in the movie Yours, Mine, and Ours, starring Lucille Ball and Henry Fonda. It was the Hollywood version. It was sweet. It was a happy-go-lucky, filled with love type of movie where a man with 8 kids marries a woman with 10 kids, or maybe it was vice versa. Anyway, they had 18 kids, and love and hilarity ensued. And in reality, it was just the opposite. Tom North has survived a horrific childhood to tell us the truth behind Yours, Mine, and Ours, and he'll be with us a little bit later in the show. But first up, pretty much everyone thought they ran away. The McStay family. Summer the mother, Joseph the dad, 4-year-old Gianni, and 3-year-old Joseph. The disappearance of the McStay family has been an extremely emotional case for those involved in the discussion of true crime. People's tempers were just flaring. It got really, really bad. Now, on WebSleuths.com, we had many issues with people just losing their tempers. Patrick McStay, Joseph's father, has been very vocal and very angry about the disappearance of his son and the family, and who can blame him? It seemed there'd be two camps, though. It seemed to be two camps. Those who thought the McStays left on their own and those who felt they did not. In fact, the San Bernardino Sheriff's Department said, yeah, the McStays went to Mexico on their own free will, case closed. And that was it. Well, after interviewing Michael McStay, Joseph's brother, radio host Rick Baker spent 3 years traveling the globe working on this book. It was released this past February. It's No Goodbyes, The Mysterious Disappearance of the McStay Family. Let's welcome Rick Baker to our show tonight. You, people, you are going to find this interview absolutely fascinating. Rick, thank you for joining us. Rick, are you, whoops, hold on, you know what, hold on, I, for some reason, it mutes everybody as soon as I go on the air. There you go, Rick, are you there?
I'm here.
I'm sorry.
I am here,
about that.
Yes. No worries.
Welcome. And we have Michael, my official, I've made him my official co-host. Michael, you're here with us, right?
I am here. Thank you, Trisha. Thank you, Rick.
Yes, this is going to be a great show.
Yes, yes.
So anyway, let's kind of go back a little bit, shall we? I want to kind of get everybody kind of go back into time, if we will. Well, actually, before we do that, Rick, can you tell us what you believed happened to the McStays when you wrote the book? What was your theory?
My theory when I wrote the book was that for whatever reason, they left the country. They fled for their lives, leaving their dogs behind, food out, blah, blah, blah. I didn't think they went to Mexico. I thought the trooper was staged, but I thought they left on their own. And, you know, I believed what law enforcement was saying from day one, that it was a voluntary missing case.
And I want to tell everybody, I've been speaking with Rick off and on today about this. We found out the McStays were murdered, buried in a shallow grave in the Mojave Desert. We found this out just a few days ago. Rick Baker is devastated. He is the author of the book, The McStays, and he is offering money back on this book. You're having trouble... I just want people to understand what type of person you are, Rick, because you are, to me, an absolutely amazing human being. Tell us how you're feeling right now. You thought the McStays ran away. That was the basis of your book. Tell us what's going through your mind right now. What are you feeling?
Well, I guess I'm devastated and I'm angry. I'm devastated because, you know, in a way, I'm grieving. I almost feel like the McStays were part of my family. They weren't. I'd never met them. I moved to Fallbrook a month after they disappeared. But I've been, you know, the last two and a half years, I've invested so much of my life into them. I felt like I knew them, and that one day I would actually talk to at least one of them and ask them, you know, what happened? Why did you leave? When I heard you know, that they had all been found and they were had been murdered, I grieved because that's not the ending that I had ever expected would happen. You know, the book, the theories that I had in the book and the theories that have come since the book was released, I was wrong. And as a result of that, that's why I am offering 100% refund on the book. You know, thousands of books were sold. And I will refund every single book. Everybody who's purchased a book, I'll refund your money as well as the shipping if you paid shipping. And you can go to my blog and get those details. So I
what's
need
your
to
blog?
Do that.
What's your blog?
The blog is rickgbaker@blogspot.com. rickgbaker.blogspot.com.
Yes, and tell us why you feel the need to do this. I find this just incredible.
Well, I feel the need to do it because I guess in my own heart, I feel like I gypped my readers and I gypped myself. Does anybody use that word anymore, gyp? Anyway, I just feel like I didn't rip them off. That's not the word. But I felt like when I wrote the book, I was convinced that at least one of the parents with the kids, you know, was alive. And most likely all four of them were alive. And I did the verified sighting thing. I went to Merida, Mexico. I've been to Costa Rica and down at Tamarindo and Haiti and, you know, these places where I really thought they had been maybe one step ahead of me. I just felt like one day I would see them. The book, you know, doesn't even give the possibility that all four would be found dead. And I feel like as an author, I didn't present that. There's a lot of information in the book, yes, that has not been published before the book came out, wasn't out in the public arena. Which is why I obviously put a lot of it in the book to try to find them. But I just feel better. My conscience is now clear, and I can move from grieving to anger because I'm not going to drop this. But I feel better that if somebody feels like, you know, I gypped them, then go to my blog, contact me. I am more than happy to refund your money.
And let's go to Michael, my co-host, who always has amazing questions. Michael, go ahead.
Well, I'm not understanding Rick Baker because I've told you I read the book last night and I didn't get the impression. Now, I know it was your hope that the family was alive, but I think you raised very good questions in the book. And I still would like answers to a lot of the questions you posed of both Dan Kavanaugh, the webmaster, who was removing money the next day after the family disappeared, and the brother Michael McStay. I think your questions are right on, and I don't feel gypped at all. I felt completely enlightened, and draw your own conclusions as you may, but I'm just sorry you feel that way, I guess. I don't understand it.
Well, and I appreciate the kind words. Thanks, Michael, but I just feel better to throw that out there. So far, only a few have taken me up on it, and I've refunded their money instantly, and I will do that until the end of the year. So the book will be off Amazon in the next day or so. You know, it's not easy like I thought it was. I contact Amazon, I ask them to take it down. It doesn't work that way. And they have to go to my publisher. Even though I own the book, it's not as simple as I thought it would be. But it's coming down, and I feel better about that. But I appreciate your kind words. Thank you.
And, Rick, we're talking with Rick Baker. He is the author of No Goodbyes, The Disappearance of the McStay Family. With the McStay family has been found murdered, buried in a shallow grave off the Mojave Desert. And, Rick, the questions that you raised in the book, like Michael said, to me they're still relevant as well. The only thing that's changed is the McStays didn't run off on their own. They were murdered. What was going on in the McStay family that would either have them running away or killed? There must have been some sort of big trauma happening. I mean, this didn't come out of nothing. Where did all this start?
Well, again, with all of the documents that I read that were provided for me and to me by these investigators that I was, you know, they were kind enough to let me look at them, thousands of documents in the end, I never saw any indication that the family would be dead. Obviously, when you look at hundreds of emails on, you know, personal emails between Joseph and Summer, and they go back 10 years or so up to a couple of days before they disappeared, you get to know a person or two people pretty well. by, you know, I mean, looking at everything that's in their emails, from their financials to the conversations they're having with friends and family and business associates, and you kind of feel like you know them. I saw nothing there that would indicate, and neither did the investigators who provided this for me, find anything that would indicate all four were dead. They were going through a CPS investigation in 2009 that got kind of jiggy and dicey, and a couple of threats were issued here and there, you know, allegedly coming. I heard about this through Patrick McStay, who said that he heard from his son Joseph. But were those threats death threats? No. Were those threats the kind that would be carried out and kill the entire family? Absolutely not. But they were threats that I believed because Joey loved his kids. I mean, he was a dad number one, and he was a great father. And if he felt like his kids had been threatened or there were going to be false charges issued against him, issued against him that might threaten his kids, taken from him, he would leave in a second, just like I would as a dad. And that was initially why I thought the entire family fled the night of the 4th.
Well, what were these charges? Who brought them to the forefront? What do we know about this? This could be very important.
And again, I don't want to get into a lot of it, Tricia, just because we're dealing with, you know, a minor, Joey's son from his first marriage, and mm-hmm. the stepfather in that family. And I know that law enforcement now, they're investigating that.
So it's a different family.
Yeah, they're spending a lot of time on that tonight, right? And so what it is, though, is it's something that could have caused them, I thought, to flee. Was that something that could have caused all four of them to be murdered? I don't believe so.
What did Joseph McStay do for a living? How did they make their money?
He was a creator, an artist. You know, I can barely sign my own name, and this guy was able to create these awesome fountains that you see in courtyards and, mm-hmm. and hotels and resorts. And he had a partner, not an owner in the business, but a partner, Chase Merritt, who was the welder and helped build the fountains. And he was making very good money, and he was a hard worker. He was a good businessman. He was a capitalist, an entrepreneur, and a talented guy.
Later on in the show, we'll be welcoming Tom North. He's written a book about his experience living in the real family from Yours, Mine, and Ours. But right now, we're interviewing Rick Baker about the McStay case. The McStays were found, and this devastates people all over the world, found murdered after missing in 2010. They were just, their bodies, actually their skeletons, were just found a few days ago in the Mojave Desert. And yes, Michael, you had a question.
Well, in the book, didn't you think that the text between Dan Kavanaugh and Joey were of a threatening nature? I sure wouldn't have put it past Dan Kavanaugh. Although, like you said, I understand. I didn't read anything that said, you know, I'm going to kill you, your wife, and children. But he really thought he had some serious cash coming to him, and he felt like he was co-owner of the business and was entitled to a lot of cash. So I, and then plus the muzzle your wife, or I'll muzzle her for you from the first child, like you said, stepfather.
Yeah, from Michael.
Yeah, there were several things that I thought were alarming enough that, well, like you thought there was reason to flee, but I don't know. I found them all very suspect.
And Rick, before
well,
you
know,
answer
you know,
that,
Dan
Rick,
Kavanaugh,
Rick, Rick, before
yes.
you answer that, explain who Dan Kavanaugh is, please.
Well, Dan Kavanaugh was Joey's webmaster for his business. Joey had a pretty lucrative website with his fountain business, parts and fountains mm-hmm. and that sort of thing. And Dan was a good webmaster. A great hacker, too, a good computer hacker. And I spent hours on the phone with Dan in November of 2012. You know, nobody had talked to him. He'd kind of stayed laid low on the whole thing since the 4th. And I spent a lot of time with him on the phone. He wanted to write his own book. He sent me his table of contents. He asked me to help him write it. And who Dan is, he's a two-bit thug. You know, he's not a serious thug. He's
uh-huh.
just a two-bit thug. He's the kind of guy who'd try to get $50 or $500 from it. After he asked me if I'd help him write his book, and I said yes because I wanted to know what he knew.
Mm-hmm.
He said, "Well, great. I'll send you a chapter, and can you advance me $2,000?" And I said, "What are you talking about?" Well, you know, you're gonna help me write it, and I need to make some money. See, that's the two-bit thug. That's all he is.
Yes. So you don't, do you feel that maybe, this can be a loaded question, you don't have to answer. Is he capable? I mean, would you be afraid of him? I mean, let me put it that way. Would you be afraid of Dan, the webmaster?
No, I'm not. I'm not afraid of Dan at all. He's a big blowhard, and he's a punk, you know, and mm-hmm. He's a con man. Could he kill someone? I don't think so. I mean, the mm-hmm. threats that you're talking about, Michael, that he made in the text messages, that sort of thing, you know, those were, again, two-bit thug kind of threats. Joey, on the other hand, responded to those. I think Joey's response made them sound more serious than maybe they really were, because Joey was just this, you know, he had integrity and he had a conscience, like some of the emails that you saw in the book that Summer would send to Joey that were terrible emails. Joey would respond by saying, "That hurt me. I can't believe that, you know, you love me. I can't believe you talked to me that way."
Right,
and
I'm
so,
going to delete it
and,
so
and
I don't
people,
ever have to look at it again.
Yeah, people on the web sleuths talk about me that way all the time. You know, it doesn't hurt my feelings. So Joey was just this nice guy, you know, and mm-hmm. I don't think Dan was anything but and is still a two-bit thug.
Let's talk about the McStay family. It's an extended family. We have Patrick McStay, the father. We have Michael McStay, the brother. And Rick, it was because of an interview you did with Michael. You're a radio host. You did an interview with Michael. And something in that interview made you go, I'm going to take time off and find out what happened to this family. Let's talk about Michael McStay, Joseph's brother. You interviewed him. What made you decide to go on the road and find out who what happened to this family right after you interviewed Michael McStay?
Well, it was on my talk show in May of 2011 in San Diego. And I had him in the afternoon, I had an afternoon slot, and I had talked to Tim Miller that morning. Tim, of course, is the president mm-hmm. and founder of Texas Equisearch. I had talked to Tim about this case, and Tim had given me all kinds of information about Mike McStay and some other things, because I asked him why he suddenly abandoned the case. You know, he went out there, Pat got him out there. Once he got there and spent some time with Mike, he pulled Texas Equisearch completely off the case. So I asked him why. Tim and I talked for a couple hours on the phone. So I asked Mike loaded questions, specific questions that I knew the truthful answer was. One of those, for example, there were four, but one was, you know, Mike went into the house, into Joey's house, I think the weekend of the 6th or 7th, and took Joey's computer. And Joey, unfortunately, had a habit of emailing to himself all of his passwords. So if you got his computer, you got his passwords to his bank account, PayPal, Wells Fargo, Chase, all of those. And Mike got into the house and took the computer. Mike says that he got in there, the first time he went was the 10th, actually, and he took the computer probably on the 13th.
Mm-hmm.
He took it home. And Tim Miller told me that when law enforcement found out that Mike had the computer, they called him and said, quote, "You have 5 minutes to get that computer to the station or we will arrest you because you're impeding an investigation and you've stolen crime scene evidence."
Mm-hmm.
So I asked Mike on the air live, once law enforcement, Mike, realized that you took Joey's computer, what did they say? And he said, quote, it's in the book, "Oh," they said, "well, because I'm his brother, it's fine. I can have it if they just call me." That was
or
four questions. And once he said that, and then I began to take a look at, you know, at that point, I think, like everybody else in Fallbrook thought from all the coffee shop circuit there, that the family was living the good life down in Mexico or Costa Rica or somewhere else,
mm-hmm.
you know. And once he said that, it, you know, flipped a switch, I guess, in my brain. And he lied about the other three questions I asked as well that I don't want to talk about. And I said, okay, I have to figure out exactly what happened here. There's something more than this family just walking away.
Let me ask you this. Michael needed to help run the business. Perhaps he just didn't want to say, I'm being devil's advocate here. Perhaps he just didn't want to say that he got in trouble by the police, and he just took the computer because he needed the information to help continue to run Joey's business or Joseph's business. Is that possible?
Well, it's certainly logical, isn't it? But then you look at all the information that came out after that, all the financial documents, and you see that on February the 6th, just 2 days after they disappeared, Dan Cavanaugh was you know, getting money out of Joey's PayPal account, $2,000 on the 6th, and the receipts are in the back of the book, Michael. I'm sure you've seen that. And
yeah.
you begin to follow his money trail. And yes, you know, Mike may say that he was taking this money to run the business, but according to Chase Merritt, Mike wasn't running the business. What Mike was doing was taking money out of the business. He was collecting receivables from fountains that had been installed, and the deposit, you know, like Paul Murphy, some of these Paul Mitchell Salon, some of those funds that were owed to Joey, Michael intercepted that money and had that money sent to his personal PayPal account. So when you started looking at the money trail, what Michael McStay was doing was taking tens of thousands of dollars out of Joey's account. And the way it worked was his Wells Fargo account, Michael couldn't actually get money out of the Wells Fargo account. So somebody, Michael or Kavanaugh, I wasn't there to watch, but one of those two who had the password, would transfer money from the Wells Fargo account into Joey's PayPal account. And from Joey's PayPal account, then they had access to it. And they would take the money out of Joey's PayPal account. Money went to Dan's a lot, you know, $12,000, $14,000 to Dan Kavanaugh on his PayPal account. He even transferred money into Kavanaugh's grandfather's PayPal account. And so Tricia and Michael and Rick tonight, if our brother went missing and he had $100,000 in the bank and a thriving business, the first thing I would do, and I'm sure you would too, is contact Wells Fargo and freeze the account to try to figure out what's going on.
Oh, absolutely.
That would have been the first thing that you and I, the three of us, would have done. And
mm-hmm.
everybody else. He didn't do that. He never froze the account. He took as much money as he could get out of it. And according to Chase Merritt, he didn't build any fountains. He didn't fulfill the orders. He, you know, Michael can say whatever he wants to say, Michael McStay. I believe Chase Merritt, because Chase left the company. He's the one who kept it going until April when he got back from Saudi Arabia and that fountain. And then he
mm-hmm.
washed his hands of it. He was done.
He was all done with it.
Yeah.
Michael, go ahead. You had a question.
Well, yeah, I was the fact that the rating, the business rating went from A-plus to F in a matter of months due to taking all these orders and never fulfilling any new contracts. No one was building any more fountains, but Michael was selling them as if he was still creating them. I mean, I find it all very suspect. But in back to what you were saying, you had thought or surmised that they were in Mexico living the high life. Wouldn't that require funds? Wouldn't we have seen withdrawals from the accounts
Joey McStay? Michael, that brings up a great point, because my first thought in this was Mike McStay was taking all this money out and getting it to Joey. And one reason why he was making all these massive withdrawals was he was funding it secretly to Joey. I thought that the 4 days that were missing from February 4 to 8 when the troopers showed up, actually it didn't show up until they hit it on the 15th, entered mm-hmm. into the database, but it was parked there on the 4th. And I thought that those 4 days were set up to help the family get out. And then the money started getting withdrawn from the accounts and they were funneling it to Joey and Summer, wherever they were. That was obviously my first theory, because that made the most sense. Because mm-hmm. if Mike McStay wasn't doing that, then he has a lot of questions to answer about his behavior, because he treated, you know, his behavior shows me that he knew that his brother was never coming back. Because you don't do that sort of thing. You don't behave that way unless you know he's not coming back.
Absolutely.
Boy, that's
right.
True. And let's talk just a little bit here, because I want to make sure that we're all understanding this chain of events here. In your book, Michael, you thought that the McStay family ran away because fill in the blank.
I didn't know. I theorized it could have been because of the CPS investigation. It could have been because Summer was doing this loan mod thing, which was jiggy. Where, you know, the loan mod thing, which was shut down by the federal government, she was mm-hmm. kind of a go-between there where she would sign people up and promise that their mortgage payment would be lowered, that sort of thing. I thought maybe there was somebody she signed up that just, you know, lost their house and they finally lost it and said, I'm going to come and kill you guys. It was something like that that caused them to flee in the middle of the night. To leave the dogs was one thing. The money in the bank, I'm sure Joey thought, would have been secure. leaving the dogs was always kind of a kicker for me because I just didn't see them doing that. I would never do that unless I had to get out of the house this second right now. So it was something like that, that they feared for their lives, or Joey feared that his kids might be taken from him by CPS.
Got it. Now let's talk about Summer. Summer is Joey's wife. And how involved was she in Joey's business? And let's delve a little bit further into this jiggy business of these loans that you're talking about. But first, part A to the question, was she involved in any way in Joey's business in making these fountains?
No. She was not a signer on any of Joey's business accounts. She had no access to any of his financials, was not involved in any way that I know of. And I didn't talk to her, I didn't talk to Joey, but based upon, you know, the evidence that we've reviewed, I don't see it.
And do you think that explain the business again. Why was it hinky? What exactly was Summer doing with these loan modifications?
Well, the way the loan mod thing was going, you know, it started in 2006, I guess, and was ramping up by 2009 and pretty much shut down in 2010 by the SEC and the federal government. And the way it would work is, you know, you're losing your house. You pay $10,000 a month mortgage payment, and with the economy, you can't afford that. You need to pay $5,000 or you're going to lose your house. So you go to this lady, which would be Summer, or Summer goes to this person and says, look, you put up $3,000 or $2,800 it was, and we can get your mortgage modified to $5,000 a month. So here's what you do. You give me $3,000 or $2,800 bucks, and then don't make your mortgage payment now for 3 months. Don't do it because we're going to be modifying. We're going to be on the phone with Wells Fargo Mortgage. We're going to be talking to the loan officer. We're going to go to bat for you, and we're going to get this fixed. And then within 3 months, your loan mortgage payment is going to come back at about $5,000 a month instead of 10, and you can keep your house. So what happened, not just with what Summer was doing, but all across the country, I had a good friend in Colorado, lost her house this way. They stopped making their mortgage payment. And once you stop making your mortgage payment for 3 months, you go into default.
Default,
so
right.
So these people go into default. They've lost $3,000. They haven't made their mortgage payment. Now the bank says, you're in default. We're going to foreclose on you. And they say, well, wait a minute. I've got this loan mod company. They're talking to you every day. And they go, Wells Fargo says, well, who's that? Nobody's talked to me. We haven't talked to anyone. And so you go, well, what? I'm losing my house. My credit's been destroyed. I haven't paid in 3 months because I was instructed not to. I gave somebody $3,000, and what have they done? They've destroyed my life. That sort of a thing. Some people lost it over.
And that tells me what type of person Summer was, which is not a very good person. It was a total scam then, right?
Tell us what you really think, Teresa. I talked to Summer's boss in this loan mod for a long time. She's in Phoenix now. And at first she wanted to talk to me, and I said, you know what, I'm flying into Phoenix, and I'm going to come knock on your door. I know where your office is. So then she talked to me, and we talked for quite a while. She promised me that every loan mod she did actually went through, though she could never prove, and I didn't ask for documentation because she wasn't part of the conversation of this case. But what she told me about Summer was she had a number of Summers doing that, a number of people like her. Mm-hmm. And as she understood, the ones that Summer brought forward that went up to Englewood, I think, is where their headquarters was up there in Orange County, that, you know, the loan mod went through. And though she wasn't sure because she had so many people like Summer under her that she couldn't deal with everybody, and I think she's jiggy too. I mean, anybody involved in loan mod business, as far as I'm concerned, was a crook. Period.
Right.
Because it wasn't legal, it didn't work, there was no integrity, and you're sucking off of these people who are in fearing of losing their home, and the $3,000 you get from them could have been used toward their mortgage payment.
Yes, absolutely.
And now, you know, by telling them to not make their mortgage payment for 3 months, I mean, you've committed fraud and caused them to lose their home. So I theorized that, Summer could have met the wrong guy, you know, the wrong person. And if he lost his home, he went nuts. That could have been one reason why they left.
Mm-hmm. And so, but why would Summer do this? Her husband is doing well. Joseph McStay is doing very well. Why would she involve herself in this kind of sleazy business.
No, Summer is Summer was so complex. That's why I wish I could have sat down with her, looked her in the eye, and just had a long conversation with her. She was someone, again, based upon all the documentation and the friends and family that I interviewed, which are numerous, about Summer to get to know her. I even had her ex-boyfriend from 94, 95, and 96 call me and tell me, like, for example, the first date he went on with her in 1995, he said he sat down and there was this little restaurant in Orange County on the beach, and the first thing Summer did was start to cry. And he said, "Why are you crying?" He didn't even know her. "Why are you crying?" She said, "Well, because my son was just killed." And he goes, "Oh, my God, what do you mean your son was just killed?" And this guy's telling me this story, and I'm thinking, "You've got to be kidding." So all of a sudden, he's thinking, "Oh, my gosh, I've got to come to her and show compassion and help her."
Right.
He finds out later she made it all up.
Oh, my God.
So Summer was not only pathological in some instances, but I think the best way to describe Summer with what I've seen, not having ever talked to her, is that she just was someone who was not comfortable in her own skin. Mm-hmm. There were times that she didn't want to be Hispanic. There were times that she didn't want to age. I talked to a psychic who called me and said, "You know, I had Summer come and sit at my table here in Vista, California, and talk about horses that she wanted and her husband and the two kids and how she just always wanted to have more and she wanted to have it on her own and do it herself." So I think that this was something that she wanted to do of herself and not take money, like be a stay-at-home housewife or whatever, and take money from the husband.
And there you go. What did her father-in-law think of her, Patrick McStay? He's a very vocal guy. I can't imagine they got along, but I understand they did.
Patrick loved her. And, when Patrick and I were first had a relationship dealing with the book in the summer of 2011, every time I went down that road of Summer having some issues here, looking at emails, he wasn't happy about it. He actually withheld some of the emails that Summer had written to others that showed that this is just a woman who was troubled, and conflicted maybe. But he loved her. And whether or not, he really knew what was going on with her or whether or not he cared, I mean, he loved Summer. There's no doubt he absolutely loved his family. And I think of all those who are grieving tonight, it's Patrick for sure and Tracy, Summer's sister, and Blanche, her mom.
What about Michael? Did he get along with Summer?
No, he did not like Summer. Susan did not like Summer. In fact, most of Joey's friends that I talked to and business associates did not like Summer. I don't think I'd talk to anyone who liked Summer. Even Summer's sister had issues with her at times. Just because Summer had a habit of burning bridges with people, she just wasn't really keen into deep relationships. She would fly off the handle and say things, and you look at these emails and you go, "My gosh, did she really say that?" And then end it by saying, "Love you," nothing happened.
Yeah, God bless.
That just burns bridges, and you shy away from someone like that. So she didn't have a lot of close friends, if any, that I could find. But Patrick loved her, absolutely.
Later in the show, we're going to talk with Tom North. Tom is one of the real kids behind the Hollywood movie Yours, Mine, and Ours, and he'll tell us how he survived a horrifically abusive childhood. But right now, we're discussing the McStay family mystery with Rick Baker. Rick wrote an incredible book about the disappearance of the McStays. They've been recently found tragically murdered and buried in a shallow grave. And my co-host, Michael, in Minnesota, has a question. Michael, go for it.
Yeah, well, we were talking about Summer, and Rick, you touched on something. If she was responsible for destroying someone's life, I can definitely see crossing the wrong person and having them come after you. "You ruined my life. Get your family in the car. Come on, I'm going to ruin yours," whatever. That makes good sense to me. And as far as Summer, when I was reading the emails, she was constantly threatening to leave Joseph if he meddled in with her father. There seemed to be some kind of issue with her father. In your investigation of the book, did you ever find out what that was all about?
Well, I don't know. I never found out what her issue was with her dad. But as far as Joey, I think it started with Joey wanting to invite her father to their wedding. And right. I think that's where it started. And of course she went ballistic. She wanted nothing to do with that. And so I don't know what kind of relationship she had with her dad. I was never able to find him. I mean, I thought I knew where he was at, but I was never able to get a hold of him. But she, you could see from those emails, and there were so many more that I didn't put in the book because they were just not good, that she could just go off, you know, and she could threaten to leave if Joey wanted to try to get his younger son to come over to the house. You know, she was going to leave him if he was going to keep doing that, because she's not a babysitter for him.
Right.
If
and
she could
now
make
you had mentioned in your first interview with Trisha that I happened to listen to yesterday as well, that you had information in your emails about all of the machinations she was going through Summer to estrange Joey from his firstborn. But in my reading of the book, I didn't see any of that. Are those the emails that you didn't include, that because you didn't want to hurt the living?
Well, there were a lot of those that I didn't include. I didn't include them mainly because of who they were written to. I didn't want to expose the recipient of those emails, so I kept them out. But basically, would make comments in emails that, you know, he expects me to be talking to this person. He expects me to just be, you know, this young boy's mom. And he expects me to do this and to do that. And, you know, I'm going to leave him if he thinks I'm going to do that sort of thing. So Joey's friends and his closest friends and his business associates that I sat down with and talked to all said that they knew that there were marital problems. They knew that, you know, Joey was a dad first. He loved his kids. He was trying to save his marriage. He loved Summer. He wanted to keep it together. But they knew that it was a struggle. They didn't want to go to the house if Summer was there. They didn't want to be around her. You know, just because she could be toxic at times.
Mm-hmm.
And again, going back to, you know, I hate to talk about her knowing what we just found out, that she had been murdered, but she was just someone, I think Beth said, who was uncomfortable in her own skin and maybe trying to figure out what she wanted in life. Maybe that's the best way to put it.
We have several questions from the chat room. We're talking with Rick Baker about the McStay murders now, and that just breaks my heart to say that. We all thought they were living the great life in Mexico, but unfortunately not. Two questions here about Summer, one from Cubby Girl and the other from Scorekeeper. First one, did Summer have affairs on Joey? And the second question is, what about Summer's name changes? So let's talk about the affairs. Do you know anything about that?
Well, you know, and I got roundly pounded by a number of people, a lot on Web Sleuths, I might add, when I mentioned the affairs. And here's how that all came out. I made it a point to go and talk to every neighbor on the cul-de-sac where in Fallbrook, where the family lived. There are some of the neighbors that were there at the time in February 2010. Had since moved on. It was kind of a transient area. Not a lot owned their home there. But there were four who were still there of the eight, nine that I talked to. And one of those men who was there had told me, I knocked on the door, I said, who I am, what I'm doing, can you tell me anything about Joey and Summer? He said, oh, I know, that's terrible, I don't know what happened to him, I think they're in witness protection, blah, blah, blah. He said, but nobody on the block really knew them. They hadn't been here that long, they kept to themselves. Maybe we saw Summer with the kids in the front yard once or twice, but we never really saw them, and nobody knew them. But there was a day that Joseph McStay came over to me. This guy had an office in his house, so he was at home all the time. And where his house was located in the cul-de-sac was he had a pretty good view of seeing anybody who came down the street. And Joseph, according to this man, who I did not put in the book, approached him and said, have you ever seen anybody, a car at the house when I'm not here? And this man said, well, I don't know you. I don't even know what you drive. Because you haven't been here that long and we haven't even met you, sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And he mentioned a specific car in color. Have you seen a car of this color and this make and model in front of my house? And this guy said, you know, I think I have seen that, because of the kind of car it was, a sports car. He noticed that, and he said, I think I did see that, yeah. And he said, what, is that not your car? Is it your wife's car? And he said, no, I think maybe my wife's seen somebody. Now, that's what the man told me.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where it started. And what I did was with my investigators and with someone in California, I tried to run down the car. It was kind of rare in the color of that model car, and was not able to find anything. So, you know, I haven't really run with it any further. I have some other emails from that I was able to contact some of the neighbors there. Was she having an affair? I don't have any idea. Could she have been having an affair? You know, according to the psychic in Vista, California, when she was talking to her, she made mention of something like that. Do I believe psychics? Yeah, I know that some psychics have solved cases. I've just never met one in my life, and so I don't pay much attention. You know, I want to be kind, but I don't pay much attention to what they have to offer. But there were, you know, two different people told me about that. So was it possible? I suppose it is with anybody, maybe, but I couldn't prove it. I couldn't find the car. I couldn't find the person, and I didn't go any further.
What about all these name changes of Summers? What was going on with that?
You know, that would have been one of the questions I would want to ask her if I could sit down with her. She had so many different aliases, and again, I think it goes back to someone who was not comfortable in her own skin. Was she a con artist? No. I think she was just someone who was trying to find her way. There were times that she didn't like her heritage. There were times that she didn't like her age. I don't know. Obviously, people look at the aliases and think that she was this dicey criminal. I don't look at it that way. I just think it's somebody who was just not happy in her own skin.
Yeah, but don't you see, though, Rick, after everything you've told us about Summer and the fact that she was involved in a scam where people were losing their houses, who knows what type of enemies she made? I mean, you use the word toxic. That's what it sounds like to me, a toxic person. In my opinion, I hope Ellie looks deeply into her friends and enemies. I'm sure they're looking into everybody's background now as we talk. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Michael. Go ahead, Rick. What were you going to say?
Well, in defense of Summer, again, not knowing her, with the loan mod, in defense of her with the loan mod, when she was involved with the loan mod in 2009, it was not yet illegal. It was dicey, and she knew that it was dicey. But at the same time, the way it would work is, you know, if I went to her and I said, I'm losing my house, and she says, give me $3,000, I give her $3,000, I fill out all the paperwork, and from that point, I'm bumped up to Inglewood or wherever the headquarters was, and I don't really deal with Summer anymore. And I'm not sure that Summer knew the extent of the fraud and loan mod. Now, I do have emails between her and her boss that I spoke with in Phoenix where she realized toward the end of 2009 that, hey, this is not good. I could lose my real estate license. This could be a real problem. And do you think I can do it this way and this way, trying to find a way to get around it? It was not illegal, but maybe a little bit jiggy. So based on those emails, I think that maybe she didn't know the extent of the fraud of this whole system, you know, prior to when it just about was exposed at the end of 2009.
And, Michael, please continue with your questions.
Yes. Well, as to the loan modifications, I read some of those emails, and among the first, I did get the impression, and again, I hate to defend Summer, but I did get the impression that she wanted to actually help some of these troubled homeowners with their loans. I didn't see it as nefarious as I wanted to. But anyway, what I found the most intriguing was this birthday party that was supposedly happening, but no one had been invited. She had been planning this Chuck E. Cheese birthday party for one of their children, Gianni, I think, or whichever. And but Chuck E. Cheese had no record, no cancellation, no friends had been invited. I thought that was very odd, and there was one other thing that really stuck out, and I had it in my head, but Tricia took too long to get to me.
I'm sorry. I'm so sorry.
So
I know
what
you
did you make of that? These are sketchy. Oh, it had to do with the house. She apparently was going to be having this open house and to showcase the house, and someone reported in you reported in your book that she would never have wanted to showcase that house because it was nothing she was proud of.
Well, she didn't want to be there. She didn't like the house, and the house wasn't in any kind of condition to be showcased. As far as the birthday party, everybody that I interviewed, a couple of her friends, quote unquote, who weren't clear, you know, deep friends, but friends I thought would have been invited, I could not find one person who had even heard of the birthday party.
Right.
Nobody was invited. And so I don't know if that's something that she was just wanted to do. I don't know if she didn't seem like she was proud of the house. She didn't want the house. She didn't want to be there. She wanted the house in Temecula that cost substantially more. You know, Joey wanted the house in Fallbrook, and they were going to be there a couple, 3 years, sell it, and get back to the beach where she wanted to be. So it's an odd thing with the birthday party. And MacGyver, who was there, really the last ones to see them, you know, was there that week, as it's detailed in the book. He thought it was odd,
yeah.
too, you know, that
doing all that painting. What a good friend. He spent countless hours painting that house, and she went off on him, like he said. She was a loose cannon.
Well, she didn't have any filter, maybe, you know. She would just say it was on her mind all times. And MacGyver is the one, I think, who introduced them. So he kind of felt responsible for the marriage, even though he knew it wasn't going very well. I spent a long time with MacGyver, you know, in a number of different interviews, and he became a friend of mine. And he's grieving too, I'm sure. I haven't talked to him. But the whole week with him was very odd and dicey too. He didn't understand a lot of it, the way it went down.
No.
Rick, let's get back to your book. You and I talked a little bit off the air today, and you said something that really surprised me. In your book about the McStay family, we'll get people up to date in case you've just joined us, Rick theorized that the McStays left on their own free will for whatever reason, and he gave some great information. Like you said, Michael, the book itself is wonderful. The information and the research you have done, Rick, on the McStay family and everything that was swirling around them is to be commended. And if anybody's getting down on you, they shouldn't, because your heart was in the right place, you were honest, and this took out 3 years. You were not getting rich doing this, that's for sure. I don't know this, but I'm assuming you spend a lot of your own money. And the thing is, you said to me that you felt like maybe you might have helped the person whoever did this, because maybe they read the book and thought that everybody was on the wrong path. I hope you really don't feel that way, because everybody thought they left. It wasn't just you. It was law enforcement, too.
Well, absolutely. You know, had I not written the book, it would have died down. And you know, the players, Michael and Kavanaugh and these others, Michael McStay, hated it when I wrote the book, because they mm-hmm. wanted it to die down, I'm sure, with the way the jiggy finances went. But, you know, here we are, and here I am with my blog that had like almost 1 million hits in a year, the one that I took down a few days ago. People from all over the world were looking for the McStays. And while the blog also got toxic toward the end because of some of the commenters, it was something that kept the case alive. And the book,
yes.
of course, in the book I'm saying, I'm posting on my blog when I go to Southport, North Carolina, looking for them, or when I go to Merida, Texas, Mexico, and whoever did this is happy, because here, you know, the family is buried in Victorville, and everybody else is looking for a family of three or four living a good life somewhere outside of the United States. So when I told you off the air earlier that I felt bad because I think maybe I helped them, I don't think I can be held responsible for that, because
right.
law enforcement themselves, as you said, this has been a voluntary missing case. And as recent as September, just a couple of months ago, when I talked to the lead investigator with the FBI, you know, she told me that this is classified as a voluntary missing case. And
mm-hmm.
and I said, okay, but let me ask you a question. I've told you that if you tell me that this is a criminal case, I will stop right now. I don't want to impede a criminal investigation. And this is classified as a voluntary missing case. I understand that, with the Sheriff's Department, with you, blah, blah, blah. But tell me that this is a voluntary missing case, or tell me it's a criminal case, and I will stop. And she said, Rick, I can tell you this. I am not investigating this case as a voluntary missing case. I said, okay, so are you going to reclassify this then as a criminal investigation? She said, no, it doesn't work that way. All I can tell you is I am not investigating this case as a voluntary missing case. So at that point, I began to back off on the blog, because
mm-hmm.
she admitted to me that this was a criminal investigation.
in so many words. You just have to read between the lines on that.
Absolutely.
Let me remind everybody, a little bit later in the show, we will welcome Tom North. Tom's family was the family featured in the movie Yours, Mine, and Ours with Henry Fonda and Lucille Ball. And in the movie, it was a happy family. In real life, Tom survived incredible abuse, and he'll be here later on to talk about that. Right now, we're talking to Rick Baker with the devastating discovery of the McStay family, all four of them dead. Murder, classified as a murder. They were in a shallow grave. Now, Rick, I understand there were two graves dug, very shallow, and two bodies to each grave. Do we know anything about the surroundings of where they were found?
Well, you know, people that I've talked to, my sources in Southern California, you had a grave that was maybe 2 feet deep where both Joey and Summer were in that grave, and their hands were bound with cord. Now, if it's only 2 feet deep, and you have two adult bodies, you can theorize that it's not going to be any time at all before animals get to that.
Right.
The other grave, there were actually three graves. The other grave that the boys were still partly in and partly out. That was very unfortunate and sad. Mm. Devastating. That's a grave that had been, the animals had been there. There was a third grave, that we're not talking about yet. Nobody is. There was nothing in it, but we're not talking about it. So
What? Third grave that was dug and just left there?
There was a third grave that didn't have a body in it, but, as I understand it, law enforcement ran forensics on that grave, and they've come up with some evidence. And, my forensic person I spoke with about three hours ago said that they're trying to run the evidence based upon that other grave, which was empty. So that's all we know so far, and that's all that's been released so far. Obviously, law enforcement and even the forensic anthropologist I spoke with, who's involved in this in a way, said that there's no way to tell if they were put there on February the 4th. It's possible that they did leave and did flee on the 4th and came back a year later, is what I was told, and then were killed. The problem with that theory is who staged the trooper? I mean, did the McStays do that? Did Joey and Summer go down there? What happened in the 4 days? And so
explain
that
the trooper. Explain
of,
the car, the trooper, what you're talking about. What? Because that is pretty interesting.
Well, the trooper, they disappeared on February the 4th, and everyone was looking for the trooper. Not everyone. I mean, once an official police missing persons was filed with the sheriff's department on February the 15th, they put the trooper in the database. They got an instant hit that it had been towed. It was down in San Ysidro by the border, and it had been parked there, according to the parking lot attendants, on February the 8th at about 5 o'clock in the afternoon. And, on February the 8th, it was cold and drizzly, and this is a real jiggy, bad area. And if you have two kids, you're not going to wander around out there in the cold and the dark. And so you're going to head to the border. So the trooper was put there. They immediately theorized, FBI, Sheriff's Department, mainly Sheriff's Department at that point, that they crossed the border. So they got the volunteers. They started, looking at the video. What is it, 250,000 people a day crossed there. And they found the grainy video that's famous now, that they said, well, this looks like the McStays. I've never believed that it was. Patrick never believed that it was. I don't think Mike McStay believed. But law enforcement said it looks like they left voluntarily, and that was them crossing the border. So if they did leave and then come back, getting back to the gravesite, and then were killed a year after they'd left in 2011 or last year or whatever, there's no way to prove that, because they're not going to be able to come up with any kind of a time frame of when the bodies were put there, based upon the condition, based upon the shallowness of the graves. We may never know, if they were killed on the 4th that night or the next day and buried there.
Rick, you just kind of gave us a bombshell, to steal a word from Nancy Grace, and that was that there was a third grave. And apparently they're processing some evidence from around the third grave. It was empty. Give us your best guess what might, and I know you probably don't like to do that, but I just have no idea what could be found that they could be processing. What do you think?
You know, I have no idea either, and I was hoping
any
I could
kind
get
of forensic.
So I don't know. You know, that could be anything. That could be that there was something there at one time, but it was law enforcement has specifically said that the third grave was empty, and you know my sources there have specifically told me that the third grave was empty, but that they ran forensics on it. Mm-hmm. So and that they thought they might get some evidence. That's all I know. That there was
the problem with the desert, though, is that, you know, if someone dies in a tropical climate, then of course the decomposition is so much different than in a dry, arid desert where everything dries out rather than putrefaction that normally happens. Isn't that correct? It's more of a mummification that happens in a desert. But anyway, I wanted to direct Rick to a question I saw on the in the chat. It wonders if you are following the Bryce Lespiza, and forgive me if I'm saying that wrong, missing person case. Michael McStay was photographed with Bryce. Any connection to the McStays missing and Bryce now missing? Do you know anything about Bryce?
Yeah, I do, but I don't think there's any connection. He went to Michael's church. The photograph that they're talking about, that he was photographed, this was just a kid, you know, somebody in his church, and this happened far away from, you know, Southern California and their church. So I don't see any connection. It just happens to be a coincidence that he disappeared and Mike was photographed with him.
I see. Okay.
Rick, we may have already gone through this, but I think I missed your answer on this, so I need to ask it again. What was the relationship with Patrick McStay and Joseph? Did they get along? Patrick
they
being
did.
The father.
Yeah, they loved
they did.
He called them.
You know, people like to talk about Pat having sued Joey in years past and on, but Pat truly, I spent hours and hours and hours on the phone with Patrick in the summer of 2011, hundreds of hours, because he and I were collaborating on the first writing of my book. I got to know him very, very well. And the one thing I can say about Patrick, yes, he's crass, and yes, he can be rude, and he doesn't have a filter either, maybe, and burns bridges pretty quickly sometimes. He loves his family. He loved Joey, and Joey was his best friend. And Joey did talk to Patrick a lot. He did call. And, you know, I think Joey loved his dad very much as well. On the other side of that, you know, Patrick and Michael, never, you know, Michael wanted nothing to do with Patrick, and Joey was not as close to Michael as people like to think. You know, Joey and Michael weren't like best brother friends, you know, not at all. But Joey and Patrick, I believe, were very close.
And you said that Patrick, that is Joey's father, was working with you on your book, and then he wasn't. What can you tell us how that happened? What the falling out was?
Well, actually, after I interviewed Mike on my radio program in May of 2011, I had a number of emails after the show saying, you have to talk to Joey's dad, Patrick, because he knows so much about Michael, and he knows so much about this case. So I was put in touch with Patrick, and I began talking to him for hours. He had so much documentation. He had so much history, and I was fascinated with that. And this was a man that I knew at the very beginning, you know, loved his son. He told me from day one that he believed his son was dead.
Mm-hmm.
He just felt like Joey was dead. And he felt that mainly because they talked a lot. And the fact that Joey had not talked to him, he said, you know, even if Joey left the country because of the CPS investigation or feared for his life or whatever, he would still reach out to me. He'd find a way to call me.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that he hadn't called at that point in a year, almost a year and a half, he felt like, you know, he was dead. So Patrick began sharing with me a lot of documentation, some emails that he had obtained, all kinds of financial documents and that sort of thing about Joey. And the idea was, I'll write the book, and we'll start a foundation called the McStay Foundation, and I'll put some money in this foundation. I'll launch it on my own dollar, and, you know, I'll write the book, and all the money, all the proceeds from the book go into this foundation, and the money from this foundation will be used to find out what happened to your family. And if we mm-hmm. find them quickly, then whatever money is left will be used to find to help other missing persons. So that was the way it started. And unfortunately, Patrick, as I said a moment ago, just doesn't have a filter, and we just didn't get along. And by August, by the end of the summer of 2011, it became very apparent to me that we just couldn't work together. We weren't going to be able to do this. And, you know, it was me, but I pretty much severed our relationship. I just wasn't able to continue. But I know today, as I knew then, that he loves Joey, and he loves the family, and he has got to be devastated and heartbroken, even though he thought Joey was dead, once he learned this, and especially his two grandkids. What kind of evil kills children?
Yes, exactly. That is a dark, dark, evil soul that would do something that horrific. Rick Baker, Michael, you have another question for Rick. Go for it.
Yeah, one of the saddest things I read in the book, Rick, truthfully, was Patrick, who always received his Friday night phone calls from Joey, didn't hear from him that Friday, and it was okay with him on Saturday. He figured that maybe they'd just gone out of town or something. But when he hadn't heard from him Sunday, Patrick, the father, reached out to his son Mike and said, "Something is wrong. I always hear from Joey. Would you run by the house and check?" And Mike responded, "No, I can't today. I'll do it tomorrow." Claimed he did. Mike claimed to Patrick, "Yes, I went and checked. You know, I couldn't, they weren't home, whatever." But in the meantime, someone, one of the neighbors of the McStays, had reported the dogs in the backyard without food and water. And so animal control had come and had actually flagged the house with a notice saying you have to contact our office. So it was obvious that Joey never did, or Mike never did go to check on the family. And I thought that was all horribly suspicious. What did you make of that, and what did Patrick make of that?
Well, Patrick eventually got pretty upset at Mike because he just wouldn't go over there. Now, Michael said that he went. He hadn't been there. Actually, Chase Merritt went to the house on Monday, you know, because he called Joey back on Thursday night the 4th, and there was no answer when Joey, there was a butt dial or whatever it was, the call that went to Chase on his counter when he was having dinner that he didn't answer from Joey that Thursday evening. He called him back later, nothing. He called on Friday, nothing. And by Friday afternoon, Joey's phone is going into voicemail. So he contacts Susan at that point and says, "You know, have you heard from Joey?" And Susan says, "No." And he says, "Well, I'm going to go check." So Chase went down to the house on Monday. And when he got there on Monday, the dogs did not have any food. They didn't have any water, which he thought was odd. You know, he had just helped Joey build a little lean-to, like, storage shed in the back on the southwest side of the house. And, I mean, I looked at that. I was there, and I saw what he built. And so they didn't have any shelter, the dogs, in the back, and it was raining. And so he put food and water in that shelter and opened it up for the dogs. Didn't go in the house, he says. And thought, you know what, maybe Joey just took off for a weekend. That's kind of odd because we were just together Thursday, and they had some stuff to do that week. Mm-hmm. But he didn't think too much of it because he knew Joey would get a hold of him. So when did Michael actually go to the house? If he went to the house, like a couple of people told me he may have, the weekend, which would have been, you know, the 6th and the 7th, then he didn't deal with the dogs. If he was in the house and took the computer that weekend, he didn't deal with the dogs, but he definitely did not go to the house when he said he did. Chase was the first one there to get the food and water for the dogs.
You know that.
Now, do we know when that notice was posted by animal control?
No, we don't. We don't have any idea. It wasn't there when Chase was there. You know, he went to the front door and they stick those notices on the door. You know, there was nothing there then. Now, one of the neighbors I talked to told me that they thought the neighbor across the street are the one who called, and the reason they called was because the dogs continued to bark over and over again. And, you know, they were, where are our people? Where are our masters, you know? So they were barking constantly late at night. And those houses are kind of close together. And when you had dogs back there and they're barking, it's going to keep up the whole neighborhood awake. So it was after Chase was there on Monday when animal control came out. I could never find anybody who'd seen the sticker. Animal control isn't going to give any information out, but it was after Monday.
Okay.
And, you know, the thing about this is, Rick, Michael, this is his brother. He goes supposedly to – goes there – well, he didn't check on the house when he said he did, but he did go and take the computer. He had to know the dogs were there. He didn't give them any food and water. You know, to me, that is a very huge red flag as to a person's character. And maybe I'm making too much of it, but I would not put anything past a person that would do that to a family pet. I'm sorry. It just sends chills up me. It makes me more disgusted than ever. I don't know if you feel as strongly as I do, but it really bothers me.
Oh, I do. And I have four animals.
Our family. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
are,
you would never leave.
Even
if, Rick, if you were fleeing for any reason, that would be the first thing in the car, for me anyway, would be my animals. It's not like I could ever forget them. Or,
they're part of my family. Yeah.
You bet they are. Yeah.
Exactly. Well, Rick, when we spoke earlier today, you talked about your mission. You feel like you have a mission now. Are you going to write another book, or are you just going to continue to kind of do a parallel investigation? What's next for you?
Well, I mentioned when we started the show that I have two emotions going on. One is devastation because I feel like I've lost part of my family. But the other emotion, which is equally as intense, is anger. I want the murderer or the murderers to be brought to justice. And I want to see that, you know, the death penalty in California is too good for them. I want to see these people dissected. I want to see them tortured to death. That's what I want to see. And I'm going to do everything in my power with the contacts that I have to help that. The one thing I will not do is in any way interfere with law enforcement. They're on this now. They have a bit of a black eye, and I believe I know with what's going on right now in Southern California, law enforcement is out and about, and hopefully there are some arrests coming in the next week. But they're on this, and if there aren't arrests coming right away, I will do anything in my power. You know, there are people who will talk to me who don't want to talk to law enforcement, and I have this extensive list of contacts and people now from around the world, really, that have come in the last couple of years. So I'm angry. And, you know, what kind of evil kills children? I want to know who did this, and I want to see them die.
Amen. Amen, brother. I couldn't say it better myself. You said you've been getting a lot of flack. People have been coming down hard on you. What are they saying? I don't get what their issue is.
I don't either. I read the book just last night, like I said. I don't get it.
What are they saying?
You've got them on Web Sleuth, and they're all over the internet, and they're posting whatever. I don't know what their issues are. A lot of them think that I did this for fame, which I don't want. I did this to make money. I haven't made any. I have spent quite a bit of my own pocket all the way through. I don't know what their issues are. If they're jealous that I've worked my butt off in the last 2.5 years, you know, I don't know. You'll always have those detractors, right? I don't pay any attention to them. I actually feel sorry for them. And they're maybe a little bit like Summer. They've lost their way, and they're not comfortable in their own skin. So misery loves company, and they've got to find somebody to nail. It bothered me at first, though, when I first started this, you know, summer 2011, I started getting pounded. It really bothered me. And I'd been, you know, a public figure for many years, but and I was a little bit used to this, but this really started to bother me. Now it doesn't bother me at all. I don't pay any attention to them. I wish that they would take those efforts and those energies that they have that hate me so much and turn them around into a positive force to maybe help with this case rather than, you know, go after me. It doesn't accomplish anything.
Well, let me tell you something. I know a lot about these types of people, believe me.
They won't do anything.
Sure.
Yeah, oh,
sure.
All the time. And they won't do anything constructive. This is what they do. They sit on their behinds and bitch because that's all they can do.
They're at the computer all day long. That's all they do.
Absolutely right. We've had several people mention this in chat, and I bet there's a lot more out there that still want to read your book, Rick. You're pulling it from Amazon. They still want, because it has great information in it. It's just the theory you came up with what happened is different than what actually happened. But the information
I didn't read it. I just didn't see it as you reaching any definitive conclusions. I thought it was more of a, here's the facts, do with them what you want, kind of like Kohler's book.
Exactly. And what and so, Rick, any chance that you might reconsider, or is it just a done deal now that you're taking your book off of the shelves?
You know, at this point, I appreciate the kind words, but at this point, I'm not going to reconsider. I actually have 500 books sitting in my office that the publisher sent me that I was going to give away. I don't think I'm going to do that now. I may give them away one day because, as far as I'm concerned, that's what they're worth to me now because I was wrong. But and my publisher, Tate Publishing, they're not happy that I pulled it. They're trying to talk me out of it, but. You know, everything's in motion. I sent the email. I made the request. It doesn't take one day. It takes some time. But as of right now, you know, I'm just not going to deal with that anymore. I just feel like it needs to be off of Amazon and not for sale.
Well,
I have a question then, Rick. Oh. I have the PDF, and I hope I'm not getting anyone in trouble. But
no, that would be me, but no, you're not getting me in trouble. Go ahead.
In preparation for the show, Tricia wanted me to read it. So I do have the PDF of the book. How do you feel about me sharing it with some of the individuals in chat who would like to read it?
You know, you're welcome, Michael, to do whatever you want with that. I know that there are, you know, thousands and thousands of e-books out there that were bought. And e-books obviously are passed around, even though you're not supposed to do that. I can't. There's nothing I can do about that. You're welcome to do whatever you want with that. That was actually a media copy, I think, that I sent to you, Tricia, right? And
right.
The revised one is, you know, a hair different, but not a whole lot. You're welcome to do whatever you want with it. I just can't, in my clear conscience, sell any more books.
Okay, so because I don't want to feel like I'm taking money out of your pocket.
Rick,
nothing went into my pocket. All the money from the book has gone to a couple of missing persons organizations and Texas EquiSearch. I haven't kept a dime. But again, just because it's a best-selling book, whatever that means anymore, that doesn't mean anything. I mean, as the author of this book, for every book that sells on Amazon, I get 97 cents. The book is what, 13, 14 bucks? What I get
what?
Back in royalty is 97 cents. That's all I get back.
97? Oh, that
now,
seems
as I
ridiculous.
Understand from Amazon, in the last 24 hours, you know, a couple thousand or more books have sold. I don't know, but they were balking at pulling it off too. And as soon as I announced I'm pulling it off, then all of a sudden people go crazy and start buying it like crazy. And now it's gone from like number 100,000 out of 11 million true crime books to number 10 or something because people are going crazy buying it. So now I have to figure out what I'm going to do with that money, with the books that have sold in the last 48 hours. But it's not like you make a lot of money. Everyone that sold from Tate, I think I got $4.50, but many more, 95% of the books sold from Amazon, and that's 97 mm-hmm. cents. So unless you're a Bill O'Reilly selling a million books, you're not going to get rich doing this.
That, and, you're,
and
you have done it.
Fortunately, my nonprofits didn't get rich. I couldn't give them that much either. So.
Right. You've done it for all the right reasons, Rick Baker, and that's why we appreciate you, and I speak for thousands of people when I say we appreciate everything you have done and will continue to do. You may have answered this again. I apologize. I'm reading chat and talking to you, and so things get just totally mixed up in my tiny little brain here. Did you say
I
you might
you're
write?
You're getting some great chat questions, too. Huh? You're not reading the fire, are you? The toxic
you know
stuff
what?
That comes in.
We haven't got any. We haven't got any. I had an obscene question, like a pervert question, but it had nothing to do with you. It had to do with me.
Oh, nice.
And that's it.
Okay.
That was it.
Yeah.
Everything else, everyone's been just incredibly supportive. But did you say you might write another book when you do this, your kind of parallel, not interfering with law enforcement investigation?
You know, the last thing I want to do, Tricia, is write another book. But I had someone who's very close to this case, a friend of Joey, someone very, very close to this investigation who I really care about. We talked for a long time today, and this individual is willing to bring some other information to the table that I didn't. And, you know, if we want to do this jointly together, and if I did something like that, it would be the kind of a book that would be released as an e-book through my publisher, but it would be free. and you would be able to download it for free. It would not be nothing that's sold. So it may be another book. It would be about the same length of the one that there is there now, with information that, you know, currently has not been out there. Again, the only purpose would maybe to bring this together. Let's try to put this in focus. What a horrendous thing, a terrible thing has happened. How could this be? You know, what could they have done that would cause all four of them, someone to murder them? So I'm considering that. You know, this person asked me if I would. I'm going to consider it. Mm-hmm. And if it helped, if I felt like it really helped, you know, I may do that. I relaunched the blog again just the 24 hours ago because I felt like there are so many McStay followers, you know, and I've met so many in the last 2.5 years, and so many have become friends who, like me, truly care. Now, they may sit at their computer. They may be invalid to where they can't get out, and they're at their computer mm-hmm. all day long, but they work very hard.
They
to
do.
Try to
I know
find
what you mean.
Family.
They're
absolutely.
Very, they're
and,
incredible
and
people.
And they care. They do. They care just as much as I do and just as much as you both do. And there was nowhere for them to just gather and chat. I mean, obviously, Web Sleuths is one place. But if you don't join in Web Sleuths, and I would encourage all your listeners to do that, obviously, I think maybe those in the chat room have. But mm-hmm. anyone who listens to this, I hope you'll join Web Sleuths. But
thank
I put
you.
The blog back up specifically for those people because we just need a place to gather to just talk because this has just knocked the wind out of us. And mm-hmm. we don't know how to respond. We don't know how to recover. I can't get my arms around it. And people who truly care, and there are thousands of them around the world, just like me, we just need a place to gather and talk. And so if I did another book, it would be for those people.
And give us the address of your blog again, please.
It's Rick, R-I-C-K, G as in Glenn, Rick G. Baker, B-A-K-E-R, .blogspot.com.
And on this blog, do you update daily what you're doing in regards to the McStay family, or what can people expect from that blog?
All I've done now with the blog, which is, again, it's only been up, you know, a day and a half or so, all I've done now is just a few posts. I wanted to have a place to announce that if somebody wanted a refund, I'm willing to give them a refund on the book. You know, I posted that there. This is not going to be as controversial or dicey as the other blog was. This is just mm-hmm. a gathering place. You know, the first post, a gathering place, not a place of accusations. We've had 7,700 hits, visits in the last 24 hours. So that shows you, I just launched it 24 hours ago. We've had 7,700 already here. That shows how many people care about
yes.
the McStays, and they're looking for answers. And so that's why I did it.
Michael, go ahead. You have a question, final questions.
Yes, I do. Rick, I was trying to access your blog, and it kept telling me that because I found something, it was Google Plus or whatever, where you were also talking about a case you're investigating, a missing person out of Salem, Salem.
Yes, Diedrich Smith. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah, and I kept clicking on all the links, and I would get a notice saying that that page is unavailable. Is there something wrong with your blog, or was that an old
well,
blog?
Well, what I had,
I think
it,
I don't
know,
believe
that
it was
same,
a.
Well, that
I didn't
same
think
name.
It was a G. In the,
well, it is. It's rickgbaker.blogspot.com. Now that same address, rickgbaker.blogspot. was the address that I had for my blog, No Goodbyes, the one that had, you know, almost 1 million hits in a year.
Mm-hmm.
That blog, which it had about 200 different posts and threads, that was kind of the main area for McStay. It had become toxic in the end, and that's the blog that I took down. Now, when I deleted it and I came back and relaunched another blog, I kept the same rickgbaker.blogspot. So if you go to Google, because it takes, you know, 72 hours a lot of times with Google and their algorithms. So when you go to Google and you Google, if you just Google Rick Baker author blog or Rick Baker McStay blog, it's going to come up either No Goodbyes, which is my old one, and that'll say this blog's gone. But hit it again when you get rickgbaker.blogspot up there, and you'll get the new one. And within a day or so, you'll be able to Google that and go straight to it. It just takes 72 hours.
Rick, has anybody asked for a refund yet?
No, I've not had anybody yet ask for a refund.
I hope they don't. I don't think they should. Your heart is in the right place. And like Michael has said, and I agree 100%, that book is full of incredibly correct and very helpful information. But, Rick, that just goes to show what type of guy you are and where your heart is by offering a refund, even the shipping. Rick Baker, final thoughts?
Let's all please pray for justice. This is not the outcome we could have ever imagined in our wildest dreams or nightmares. Let's continue to pray for law enforcement, that they go down the right roads now, that I know they're working very hard, and that this case is solved very quickly, and these murderers are brought to justice. And let's pray for Patrick and Tracy, Summer's sister, and her mom, Blanche.
Thank you, Rick. I know we're going to have you on again, and it will hopefully be with some good news and hopefully with an arrest very, very soon. Rick Baker, you are an angel. Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you so much for what you're doing, you two, and I appreciate it. Have a good evening.
Take care
now.
I
sure enjoyed talking with you, Rick. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
What an honor.
Good night. Thank you.
It is an honor, isn't it? He's just a great guy.
Absolutely.
You know, and Michael, he's very sincere. He is really broken up about this, and he feels that he owes people the money back on his book, I'm glad to hear that nobody has taken him up on it yet, because anybody that has even listened to Rick Baker just a little bit knows that obviously he doesn't make any money. It's all, every bit of it's donated to charity.
Even hear people out. I don't understand why they would attack him. I don't understand people. They get so hot about things mm-hmm. they know nothing about. They get ideas in their heads about what they know. And someone who's spending their own dollars going here and hither and yon and investigating, mm-hmm. who actually knows what they're talking about, and then suddenly gets victimized by these people. I just can't understand it.
I know. If you try and figure out, Michael, it'll make you crazy, because you can't use realistic and normal logic when you're dealing with crazy, mean people like that on the internet. That's the one thing I have learned. Okay, we're going to switch gears now. We have a very fascinating guest. Now, you all remember the movie Yours, Mine, and Ours with Henry Fonda and Lucille Ball. Man and woman, they meet and they marry. One has 10 kids, the other has 8 kids. And it's just a loving, hilarious, filled, emotional film, all based on a true story. That's what made this film so memorable, because it was based on the true story of a family that was just filled with love, and it was just a bunch of baloney. The family it was based on, it was a very abusive family. And we have with us tonight, I'm very honored to have with us tonight, a gentleman, Tom North. Tom North is here. I'm going to get him on the air right now. There you go. Tom, are you with us?
I can't wait to hear from him.
I know. Tom, are you there?
Hello, Tricia.
Hi. Thank you so much for waiting, and I appreciate your willingness to kind of juggle your schedule a little bit. We had to talk to Rick first, and I appreciate you waiting until this time to talk with us. But we have plenty of time left. And Tom North, you grew up in the family that Yours, Mine, and Ours was based on. And don't forget about the remake in 2005 with Dennis Quaid and Rene Russo. You grew up in that family. Now, first of all, everyone's seen the movie. I've seen it. And the thing that bugged me about the movie was Lucille Ball was way too old to play that part, but she did. Anyway, that's a whole other TV show. That's a whole other radio show. You grew up in that family. Explain the dynamics first. Who had the 8 kids? Who had the 10 kids? Who was who? Where did you fit in? Let's start at the very beginning.
That's a good place to start. So for the benefit of your listeners who don't know the backstory, Mrs. Helen North had 8 children. She had 7 children, and she was pregnant when my dad, Richard North, who was a Navy aviator, was killed flying experimental aircraft. So she was left with her 8 children, and shortly after the death of her husband, my dad, she met a man who had 10 children. His name was Frank Beardsley, and he was a widower. His wife had died of adult onset diabetes after the birth of their 10th child. So Mr. Beardsley met Mrs. North, and they were married, and that's 8 children plus 10 children. Of course, that equals ridiculous.
Yes, it does. It really does.
Yes, it does, but that's what happened. And so the paper, because it was such an unusual event, this merger of two large families, it was carried in the papers all over the country, and Lucille Ball saw it, and she contacted my mother and stepfather and suggested that a film be made about the joining of these two large families. Keep in mind that this was the early 1960s, and this was the era of sitcoms about white suburban families like mm-hmm. Leave It to Beaver and My Three Sons and Ozzie and Harriet, if you remember those. Maybe you're too young to remember those.
Oh, I wish, but no, I grew up with them too. I'm right there with you,
Tom. I did too. Yep, the Brady Bunch came in the 70s, but
all
yep,
of
I
that.
Remember too.
Right. So what Lucy wanted to do is she wanted to make the great American sitcom on steroids, and she succeeded in doing that. Yours, Mine, and Ours was a very funny, heartwarming, very entertaining movie, and I've seen it more than a dozen times myself, and I laugh every time because Lucy mm-hmm. was the queen of comedy. Mm-hmm. So the irony is that I am the 11th child of the 20, what eventually became 20 children, because within 3 years, Frank Beardsley and my mother, Helen North Beardsley, had two more children.
Oh, dear.
So you're at 20 now. Yes.
Yeah. So that became Yours, Mine, and Ours with the addition of the two. And so the irony became that all the children in the family were expected to support this fantasy of the Hollywood version of their family life, when actually the reality that they were living was that Frank Beardsley was psychotic. Mm-hmm. And he was a very dangerous man to be around, and he could erupt at any moment, and we never knew who his next victim was going to be. So it created a very stressful environment for children to grow up in, and so it was just a very, very difficult time in the lives of those 20 children.
And when you say that Frank Beardsley would erupt, one of the things I'm trying to do with this, with my radio show, is to let people know what child abuse really is, and that includes yelling and screaming and being degrading and terrifying your children. You don't have to be beaten to death or near death to be considered a victim of child abuse. So when Mr. Beardsley would explode, what would that involve?
Well, he was an extremely violent man, and he was, interestingly and unfortunately, during World War II, he was a contender for the welterweight boxing championship of the Pacific Fleet.
Mm-hmm.
So he was a trained fighter, and he brought that the violence of the boxing ring into his home. And
oh,
so
dear.
I would be walking down the hallway, come around a corner, and there he would be, and he would knock me across the room, and I would say, "What was that for?" And he would say, "Just for drill." And that's the kind of a man he was.
Tom, that's terrible. Tom, I have a co-host. He's a wonderful man, Michael in Minnesota, and he is here, and he has a question for you.
Yes, first of all, I want to say a couple things. I'm assuming then that Frank Beardsley was not your father. He was your stepfather, and you were the child of the mother. Correct?
You are correct, Michael.
And I read an article of an interview that you had done, and you grew up with this man calling you stupid. And it was a really poignant story of you meeting your first grade teacher, and you didn't even recognize her, but she told you, "I remember you because you were so smart," and your comment was, but that's impossible. I'm stupid. You were indoctrinated by this man to believe you were an idiot. Is that correct? And
that
how
is
tragic
also correct.
Is that? Oh. Tragic.
I'm sorry. Did you have another question related to that?
Well, he was just asking, and how was that? I mean, it was just tragic. It was just horrible. I mean, that must have affected your whole life.
Well, it did. It's taken, you know, the in the book that I wrote, True North, The Shocking Truth About Yours, Mine, and Ours, about a third of the book is about the sort of the descent into darkness, mm-hmm. The very difficult time of living in the Beardsley household. The rest.
Now, how old were you when the families merged? Did you say that already?
No, I didn't, Michael. I was 7 years old when my mother married Mr. Beardsley. And so, excuse me, the difficulty began right then and carried right until I was 17 when I left home. So I was there for basically 11 years and left as soon as I could. But the problem was is that Frank Beardsley was demeaning to everyone, mm-hmm. and he was sort of an equal opportunity abuser.
So none of the children were his favorites, his natural children.
No, it was just a function of who was available for him to vent his internal anger upon.
And your mother was unable to intervene or was blind or what? Tell that story. I don't think any of us can understand how a mother can stand by and watch such things.
Well, it's interesting. It's an interesting question, Michael. The intention that my mother began with was to save this man from himself and to save his children from him.
Mm-hmm.
And to grasp that, you have to understand something about the woman. In fact, I devote the entire second chapter of the book to Helen North. And she grew up during the World War II years, where everyone sacrificed for the war effort. If you've read history books or have older relatives who were alive at that time, what you'll know is that they had resource drives where they collected scrap metal and all kinds of, they collected rubber, and everything was directed towards the war effort.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a time of self-sacrifice and working for the cause. So my mother grew up during that time, and she really retained as the war ended and life went on, she retained this attitude of selflessness and sacrifice for everyone else. And so she thought, being the good Irish Catholic that she was, that her martyrdom would be worth it if she could save this man and his children. What she did is she took her own 8 children into a very dangerous environment, and then she lost control of it.
And Tom, the thing about people like your mother, they were, like you said, raised during World War II. They were also raised that the man of the household was the one in control, and if you were being abused, you kept a lid on it. It was too embarrassing. You didn't go out and tell anybody. Did she tell you, be quiet, kids, don't say anything? I mean, how did she react when this happened? Or did she just literally just shut down and she wasn't even there? Give us an example of what she would do when your stepfather would explode.
Well, in the first few years, she would step between him and his victim and intervene and do everything she could to diffuse the situation, whatever it was.
Mm-hmm.
And as time wore on and wore her down, the constant stress, if you can imagine trying to run a household with 20 children in it and deal with this crazy man at the same time and then deal with all of the demands of all these children at various stages of development. It's really a taxing task to ask someone to perform. And yet she tried very hard in the first few years, and she just became exhausted with it. And
mm-hmm.
the unfortunate development was, and this is actually, if you talk to psychologists, they'll tell you that this is not uncommon, is that eventually she began feeding the children to him to save herself.
Oh, God, that is just awful. We're talking with Tom North, author of the book True North, The Shocking Truth About Yours, Mine, and Ours. And I want to let everybody know, as terrible as all of this is, Tom has come back, and he's done it through an amazing way that will be able to help a lot of you, I think. So there is a very good ending, if you will, to this story coming up. We're just building up to it. And my co-host, Michael, has an excellent question. Michael?
Yeah, I want to know, Tom, if you maintained a relationship with either your mother or Beardsley once you were able to leave the house at 17, and were you ever able to make peace with them?
Well, that's an interesting question, Michael. I was specifically devoted to my mother. In fact, from the age of 17 till I was 22, I continued to work in the family business, which was a donut shop called Beardsley's Ye Olde Donut House. And that was the business that Frank Beardsley purchased when he retired from the U.S. military. And all of the children worked in the donut shop and various shifts during the summer months. My shift was 12 midnight till 12 noon.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, it was pretty grim. But everyone worked in the donut shop, and I continued to work there until I was 22 years old to help my mother, to sort of be one of the supporters of the family effort. And so I, in fact, later in the book, I talk about the family therapy sessions where we took the entire family through therapy. And I hope I'm not jumping forward too far.
No, that's
but,
fine.
Yeah, that was as much for my mother as it was for the different family members. And so I did everything I could to help my mom throughout her life, but she was a very stubborn woman. Early on, before she even married Mr. Beardsley, her family, her brothers and sisters, of which there were 10 in her family, Irish Catholics, you know. And so there were 10 in her family, and they all told her, don't do this. This is not a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
And she ignored them all. She said, no, this is something I have to do, and I have to save those kids, and I have to save this man. And she wouldn't listen to anyone.
That is just awful. We have a question from the chat room. Oh, I'm sorry, Michael. Let me just ask this, and I'll go to you next, okay? When Beardsley was dating your mom, was he nicer then? And did he put on a good face, a good show, or was he always this way?
He did put on a good show. You know, the thing about sociopathic people is that they can be very charming. And He was a good dancer. He could be very charming. And once we were in his presence, though, for any period of time, we found out that this was just a facade and that the real man behind the charming front was dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, when Lucille Ball came to Carmel to meet the family, and meet my mother and meet the woman that she was going to play in the film, she met my mother and stepfather, and she very soon after took my mother aside and admonished her, saying, you keep that man away from me.
Mm.
And she had picked up on his energy right away. She was
immediately.
She was a brilliant woman, and I got the distinct sense that she was all business and maintained a tremendous amount of control wherever she was, and she was not going to have him in her environment.
Michael, you had a question. Go ahead for Tom North.
Well, I don't know if Tom answered my first question about did he maintain a relationship. So you worked in the donut shop. Did your mother stay married to Beardsley for the rest of their lives?
So what happened there, Michael, is that, and excuse me for digressing away from your original question, but I did stay in touch with my mother until she passed away in the year 2000 and supported her as much as I could. I really did not want anything to do with Frank Beardsley, so I stayed away from him, and in fact, he was not welcome in my home. My children grew up, I have two daughters, and they grew up with the reference to the evil stepfather. So they never knew him, and that was by design. He was not a healthy person for children to be around. So, I'm sorry, what was the second part of the question?
Did your mom stay married to him then for the rest of her life?
So in about 1990, I approached my mother as her health was failing, and I said to her, you know, Mom, every day, every night, you get into bed with the man who molested your daughters and beat your sons, and that is extremely toxic.
Mm-hmm.
And if you stay with him, you will die. And if you leave him, you will have a chance to make some sense out of the rest of your life. So your choice. And she told me I didn't know what I was talking about, which was what she had always told me. And so what happened is that her health was failing to a point where she needed the best care that money could buy. And one of her sisters is extremely wealthy. So we shipped her off to see her sister. And her sister, my aunt, told her exactly the same thing without any contact with me at all.
Mm-hmm.
And so she was a very wise woman, and so she had told my mother the same thing, that if she stayed with Frank Beardsley, she would die, and that the toxic nature of that relationship would kill her. And so she left him and spent the last 10 years of her life on her own.
And was she happy?
Good.
Was she a happy woman?
She did not force him, though. She wanted half of his retirement benefits that he got from the United States government,
mm-hmm.
his military retirement pay. And she wanted half of that. So if she had divorced him, she would not get that at all.
Right. Well, good for her. I'm glad she got something out of it anyway. I find it interesting that you call him Mr. Beardsley. I think, has it always been like that? Did he make you address him that way?
Yes. Well, we always had to address him as Sir or Dad. And any effort to say, but you're not my dad, was met with the back of a hand.
We're talking to Tom North.
Unbelievable.
Tom North is the author of the book Truth North, The Shocking Truth About Yours, Mine, and Ours. We all remember that great movie, and this is the truth behind it. Didn't anybody outside of the family suspect anything? And let me say this. Even if they did, they probably wouldn't have said anything because of the time that this happened. But did anyone else ever see any of this going on? You mentioned a couple of people. Were there any others?
There were, Tricia. You brought up the interesting point about the social environment of the day, where people minded their own business and just accepted things like you mentioned, such as the male domination of the household.
Mm-hmm.
But on one particular occasion, my stepfather, Frank Beardsley, went after one of my sisters and was going to beat her, and so she ran out the door. I stepped into the doorway to give her a chance to escape, and she did. I got thrown across the room, but it did buy her some time. And so she and I and one of our other older sisters went up to the local Catholic church at the Carmel Mission Basilica, and we went to the rectory to talk to the priests because we thought for sure the priests would help us. So I told the priest what was going on and that we needed help. And he said that he looked down at me. I was all of about 9 years old at the time. And he said, Tommy, he said, you are guilty of the sin of calumny, which is saying something bad about someone in a person of in a position of authority. And he said, You're guilty of the sin of calumny. And he said, I want you to go home and apologize to your father. And I said, he's not my father. And the priest looked down at me and said, oh, but of course he is.
Oh,
and he said, and then I want to see you on Saturday morning in the confessional, young man. And so that was it. We were done. There was no one who was going to help us. And we knew if
What about your 10 or your 9 aunts and uncles on your mom's side, or her parents, grandparents? No one was aware? Did he put on a front in front of everybody if they visited?
No, eventually he turned on them. He tried his best to be charming in front of them, but that didn't last very long. And eventually he banned them from the household. They were no longer welcome.
No.
Yeah. Now, interestingly, the next day, after we had gone to see the priest at the church, if I might finish that anecdote, I came home from school, and my mother was at her usual station by the ironing board, and she used to iron feverishly to, I think it was her way of processing the stress of her day. And so she was ironing, and I heard her say, Tommy, come here. And I knew that ominous tone in her voice, and I went over and I said, yeah, Mom. And she said, young man, she said, if you ever tell anyone what goes on in this household, it will be the last thing you ever do.
Oh my
no.
God.
Yeah, she said, I have never been so embarrassed as when Father Dudenay called me this morning and told me about your visit last night. She said, don't you ever do that again. Now get out of my sight. And so that was her response to that event.
Tom, have you forgiven your mother?
I have. You know, I spent a lot of time with her when she was as she was dying over several years, and she died of Parkinson's related complications. And so there were several of us who were very supportive in her declining years, and I spent a lot of time with her. And so I did get an opportunity to make peace with her. And so,
did she ever realize what she had done?
Well, there's a whole section, chapter 26 and 27 of the book are related specifically to the family therapy sessions.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my younger brothers confronted her about having taken her 8 children into a dangerous environment and abandoning us all in that. And she realized that she had done that, and so she apologized. She said,
good.
Oh, my God, I did that, and I'm so sorry.
That helps. Michael, you have another excellent question. Go, my dear.
Well, I'm filled with questions, of course. And something you said earlier, you said your Frank Beardsley beat the boys and molested the girls. Now, are you saying he was sexually molesting his daughters or the children, female kids in the house?
Yes, he was, Michael, and he even attempted to sexually molest me. So I got out of his presence as quickly as I could, but I knew what he was doing, and that is also in the book.
And believe me, everybody listening, we do get to a very happy and positive part of this story. It's just, this is such an amazing story. But is it surprising, really? When you think about the Hollywood version of anything, Hollywood version of anything, it's always not what the real life version is. Your father and mother, were they involved in the movie very much? And did Lucille Ball or Henry Fonda see any of this type of behavior at all?
Well, Lucy did see that behavior when she visited, and that was the last time she visited. Henry Fonda was never visible. He was actually a little bit of family trivia or film trivia. The part was originally offered to Fred McMurray. but he was not available. And so Henry Fonda just happened to be available at the time, and so he took the role and was very, very convincing in the role of Frank Beardsley. He
yes.
played the wise, loving, very understanding and patient father figure, and, you know, we can only wish that that had been the real Frank Beardsley.
Michael, go ahead with your questions. I know you're just, you are, I can tell you're bursting. There's a whole bunch inside of you. Go ahead.
Absolutely. Tom, what is your relationship with your 19 siblings? Are you close to any or all or some, or how does that work out?
Well, one of the things that I talk about in the book is that when my mother passed in 2000, it was my expectation that the two families would go their separate ways. They were very much like oil and water, and in my opinion, should never have been joined in the first place. And in fact, that's what happened. The two families went their separate ways, and there's not much communication between the Beardsleys and the Norths. So,
now, what about the two children that they had together?
And so they are, those two children are more in touch with both sides of the family. And so there's some crossover there, but the original families, the North and Beardsley children, don't communicate much.
At all. So you never had heart-to-heart with any of the Beardsley? He wasn't...
Well, yes, I did. Actually, when I finished the book, it was advised to me. I received some advice that it would be a good idea to let them read it, and so I did. I sent the book to everyone and gave them an opportunity to read it, and two of the Beardsleys offered to sue me if I published. And so I spent the next 18 months or so revising the book and taking all of the Beardsley children out of the story completely. And
oh,
so,
you're kidding.
No, I had to do that there for legal reasons. There are absolutely no references to Beardsley children in True North, The Shocking Truth of Yours, Mine, and Ours.
So are they denying it?
So in the 10 years you lived with that family, you never formed any kind of bond with a single Beardsley?
No, it's not that I didn't form any bonds. In fact, the older male Beardsley children, I was really, you know, I was a little boy, and they were in their teens. And then as time went on, I was very much looking up to them on a regular basis and hoping to get some sort of male guidance in the family. And
yeah.
So I was attached to them until they moved away, and you know, because you know they grew up to be old enough to go away, and they did. But it was, you know, very much a case of blood versus water.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was the connection that the Beardsleys have with each other is pretty strong and born out of adversity, and the connection that the Norths have with each other is very strong, also born out of adversity. But it's a very interesting and different kind of adversity.
Yeah,
and
I don't understand.
Well, interestingly, you know, the North children had a reasonably stable life before the death of Richard North, my dad.
Mm-hmm.
And the house that I remember as a little boy was filled with laughter and love and my parents playing with their children and my dad teaching his children as they became old enough to hunt and fish and enjoy the great outdoors. And he was a wonderful man and a very loving and affectionate man. When he died, the North children were thrown into an environment that was 180 degrees in the other direction. And so
360, yeah.
Yeah. But interestingly, when Helen North came into the lives of the Beardsley children, she was a breath of fresh air.
I bet.
And so
initially,
they had a very different perspective than the North children had. And so they look upon her as their savior, where we're looking upon her as, what were you thinking, woman?
Mm-hmm. Right,
why did
you
do this to us? We do have some questions in the chat room that I would like to address. We're talking with Tom North. Tom North is one of the kids in from, not actually he wasn't in the movie, but he was in the real-life family that the movie was based on, that movie being Yours, Mine, and Ours, and we're finding out just how horrendous this childhood was. Did Mr. Beardsley, molest any of his own children, or was it just the North children?
Well, that's a question that is going to have to, I would have to say that yes, he did. I don't want to go into too much detail there.
Sure.
But it is, he was, as I said earlier, he was an equal opportunity abuser, and he was an equal opportunity molester. He did not distinguish between his own children or anyone else's children, and in fact, I heard from one of the neighbors not too long ago that he even molested one of the neighbor children.
Oh, dear Lord.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
We have a couple, more.
Really just a really bad guy.
A couple more questions in the chat room. Couple more questions here. You said, and this kind of, I want to touch on this a little bit, you said that you had to remove any mention of the Beardsley children because two of them threatened to sue you.
Yeah.
You sent them the book before it was published. So did they deny then that any of this happened? I mean, are they not dealing with it? What is their deal?
So I have been interviewed on local television and local radio, and of course any journalist who wants to do a television coverage of this story obviously would go to the other side and say, we'd like to have your comment as well.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
The public comment from the Beardsleys has been that they do not support anything in True North, The Shocking Truth About Yours, Mine, and Ours, and they don't support any of the comments that I have made to the media.
Well, that's just not dealing with reality. That's really actually very sad, if you ask me. What do you know about Beardsley's childhood? Obviously, he had to have a horrific childhood as well. That's one of the things that we're starting to recognize is this cycle of abuse and how it needs to be stopped. I bet you could follow his family tree all the way to the abusers back to the 1600s. But do you know anything about this man's family at all?
Yes, and that's actually part of the story. And
mm-hmm.
I explain as much information as he shared with me, and I heard this directly from Frank Beardsley himself, is that he was the second youngest of 12 children, and he was born to an Irish Catholic bank teller in San Francisco, and his mom was a domestic in the households of wealthy San Franciscans. And he, as a child, was locked in the cellar with food and water and left there because the older kids were at school, and his mom and dad were off working. And so basically he was put in a dungeon and abandoned
mm-hmm.
there. And he told me that he would scratch the doors and pound on the doors until his hands and fingers bled, begging for someone to let him out. And no one ever did.
No,
so,
and this is what happened.
And this is what happened.
Michael, I want to start to get into the positive end of this story. So do you have any other questions before we kind of shift gears a little bit?
Well, it's more of a statement, or I don't know if there will be a question in it, but given the fact that Beardsley was so incredibly abusive to both sides of the family, his own children and your natural siblings, I just find it odd that stronger bonds didn't form between the Beardsley children. Children, I'm thinking of, like, children in any kind of, you'd think that they would bond together and to try to overcome the insanity that you were living. And I just think it's so incredible that even to this day, it's like they're defending this man's image or reputation is more important than living in the truth. It's beyond anything I can comprehend, I guess. I'm having such a hard time.
It's mind-boggling, Michael, that would develop that way. But recently, of course, Frank Beardsley passed away in December of 2012.
And oh, wow, recently.
Yes, not that long ago. And, of course, I was not present for his funeral, but it was shared with me by one of my brothers who did go that the references to Frank Beardsley by his own children were just loving, and I had to shake my head wondering what household did they grow up in, because the descriptions they made of this man were certainly inconsistent with the memories that I have. So there is there's a complete denial there. There's a desire to support the fantasy of the movie because it's more socially acceptable.
I'm really surprised from what I've read of Lucille Ball that she obviously picked up on what was going on, that she wouldn't have somehow, with her incredible power, have done something to intervene on you children's behalf. I just can't. Oh, this is so shocking, and I can't even believe it.
Well, keep in mind that, again, this is the 60s, and people didn't poke their nose into the business of others. And Lucy had a goal. She had an objective to make a comedy, and when she saw what was going on in the house, that was not consistent with her objective, and so what is she going to do? You know, this was not something that she could have intervened in and made a difference, because she's one person, and although with her power as the queen of comedy and a major celebrity and national personality, perhaps she could have done something, but she didn't, and you know, maybe we'll never know why.
Okay, Michael, anything else? We're gonna twist it around to something positive, but I know you're still kind of bursting, so I want to get them all out before we go.
Just the one last thing. You talked about the therapy, and I know it's in your book, but when you talk about the therapy that your family went through, was that only the North side that participated in therapy, or were the Beardsley also involved in the therapy?
Okay, so that's a great question. The very first session was four from each side, and in the second session, which there were three, just to share a little bit of detail with you there, we got together on a Saturday morning not really knowing what we were in for. We went 10 hours on Saturday and 10 hours on Sunday.
Oh my gosh.
The poor therapist just took on an enormous task. But she stuck with it, and it was so positive and it was so productive that we thought, oh, we've got to get other members of the family to come. And so we went out and proselytized to the rest of the family to come on the second month, where we had set a date. And so on that occasion, 14 showed up from both sides of the family. And we went 10 hours on Saturday and 10 hours on Sunday. And it was incredibly cathartic and wonderfully productive. And so on the third therapy session, we decided to see if we could get the parents to come. And on the Saturday, my mother came. And so she was the beneficiary of all of the work that had been done before her. And she got a tremendous amount out of it, and she said, you know, tomorrow I'm going to bring Frank. And he came. He came on the Sunday. And it was amazingly cathartic.
What happened in that session, if you don't mind me asking?
Well, I guess people just have to read the book to find out what happened.
It's that good. I can't imagine a man like him trying to accept therapy. I can't imagine him actually doing it. But let's move on.
Did he ever apologize? Can you tell us that?
Anybody? I can tell you that that question is addressed in that chapter of the book. And people will have to read the book to find out whether he did or not.
Do you find that? Okay, so we had this big therapy session, okay,
yeah.
And then you have
How
been
old
able.
How old were you all then?
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
Well, we were all adults, Michael. Excuse me, Tricia. But we were all adults, and the youngest one I think at the time was in her early 20s. Maybe
oh,
mid-20s.
I see. Okay.
Go
okay.
ahead.
Right,
you had a...
Sorry.
Yes, that's okay. No, it's a good. That was a good question to find out how old you are. Tom, you have been able to turn your life around, and you've done it in an amazing way. Let's start talking about how you slowly climbed out of that kind of dungeon that you were in, metaphorically, into the sunlight, into the world that you can enjoy, and into a place where you could love, and you knew that you would never be an abusive person. Let's talk about that journey.
How did that start? That started because during my teen years and on into my early 20s, I was a drug addict. And,
mm-hmm.
Children or young teenagers attempt to deal with very, very difficult life circumstances, it's common to self-medicate. And we self-medicate mm-hmm. with drugs and alcohol and various forms of substance abuse. And I was no exception to that. So when I was 22, a friend of mine introduced me to the local teacher of Transcendental Meditation. And so I began practicing TM, and it was amazing because I noticed a change in my own demeanor immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And so I began practicing Transcendental Meditation, and that was really the beginning of my recovery.
And at what age was this?
I was 22 years old.
And if you don't mind me asking, how old are you now?
And I just had my 60th birthday.
Fantastic. So it was TM that basically brought you out of this. I find that unusual in that it's usually, you know, psychotherapy, antidepressants, therapy in general, and mixed in with TM. But you feel that TM is what brought you back to life, right?
Well, what happened is that I have a friend, he's still one of my best friends in the world, whose father was very, very prominent in the early days of the psychotherapeutic world. And so he ran an institute called the Western Institute for Group and Family Therapy.
Mm-hmm.
And I would go with my friend and visit his dad's institute. And I heard voices coming through the wall that were in catharsis. They were doing sessions, and I happened to walk by, and I heard people expressing the emotions that I felt.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted so desperately to be able to express those emotions myself. So I asked the dad, Dr. Bob Goulding, if I could participate in these therapy sessions. And he looked at me very deeply and very seriously. And he was, I'm sure, wondering why a 17-year-old boy would ask
mm-hmm.
to go into group therapy. And so he said, yes, you come next Saturday and we'll get you into a session. So that was really when my group therapy or my therapeutic process began. But it wasn't until I was 22 that I began practicing meditation. I had had a taste of therapy. And honestly, I've been in and out of therapy all my adult life.
Mm-hmm. No, you'd have to be. I mean, my gosh. So was there ever a time in your life, Tom, when you felt, oh, my God, I'm turning out just like one or both of my parents? Did you ever have that scary moment? Or had you decided from the beginning you would never, ever be like this?
A lot of us, as we become adults, decide that we are not going to be like that, like our parents were, and
mm-hmm.
that we're going to be different. The interesting things that I have discovered is that there is programming structured in our brains, software programs, if you will, that are triggered
by the most innocuous things. I share with the readers an anecdote from when my older daughter, who's now 26, when she was about 15 or 16 months old and was barely able to walk. She'd only been walking for three or four months.
Mm-hmm.
And she tried to help me do the dishes once. And it's in the book. And I had this voice in my head say, beat her, hit that child. She could hurt herself, punish her. And I thought to myself, oh, my God, where did that come from? And I knew immediately it was Frank Beardsley.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was fortunately, I had been practicing meditation for many years at that time and had been through therapy. And I knew that that was not a good instruction. And so I just said to myself, hey, leave her alone. See what she's going to do. And what she did is she picked up a pot lid and she walked over and put it away and in the cupboard where it belonged. And then she turned around and smiled at me like, aren't I a big girl? I helped Daddy do the... And I could have killed that child's desire ever to be helpful again.
Mm-hmm.
And fortunately, I had the restraint to not follow through with the errant software that was triggered in my brain.
Man.
Unfortunately, I think a lot of people succumb to that errant software that
Absolutely.
Their parents have been... Yeah.
They do. And that's why stopping the cycle of abuse is what it is all about. Yes, Michael, what is your question?
Well, I'm thinking for Tom, it must have been helpful for you once you finally started going into meditation to revisit those first 7 years that you had in the happy family. Did you find yourself going back to a happier time in your memory and touching on the father who was loving and gentle and kind?
Great observation, Michael. I have often thought that I have been extremely fortunate to have had that influence in my life during those most important formative years. Because we all know, those of us who have looked into the psychological development process as we age, most of our programming is in place by about the age of 18 months. We've been observing our parents for that period of time, and most of our behavioral programming has occurred by that age.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest is just bits and pieces. So I was very fortunate in that respect.
You were lucky that you had such a happy childhood in the early beginnings. I'm sorry, Michael. I didn't mean to interrupt. Go ahead.
No. I was thinking the same thing. That is your saving grace. If you had never known that, I just can't imagine where you'd be today. You have to be able, during meditation, to focus on something other than, well, I know it's just about the present and breathing and being very present in the now, but without having any kind of good, solid basis to ever have reference, be able to reference, would have been impossible, I would think.
Mm-hmm.
One of the interesting things about meditation is that it is a non-specific stress release.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the features of meditation, is that deep-rooted stresses in the nervous system are allowed to be released in a very effortless way, and that's a real benefit. But some of those deep-rooted stresses come out in a very similar way that they went in. And so we can, in some cases, re-experience things coming out the way they went in. I dealt with depression for years and years and years, both before and after I began to meditate. So it's a daily process of recovery, and I'm still in recovery. Anyone who has been a substance abuser and has gone through recovery knows that it is an ongoing process. It's one day at a time.
What was your drug of choice when you said you were...
Oh, I tried them all, Michael. I really had it, and I say in the book that I smoked pot almost every day for 5 years, And then I experimented with hallucinogens and was quite fond of cocaine. And that was almost my undoing. And so I was, and I share in the book the anecdote of when I stopped doing drugs, and that was all around cocaine.
Well, thank God you never went the heroin route, because that would have given you the feeling of peace that hooks so many heroin addicts.
Yes,
correct.
And that's exactly why they choose heroin, for that reason. We're talking
right,
with Tom North. Tom North is the author of the book True North, The Shocking Truth About Yours, Mine, and Ours. Tom, did you see the 2005 movie of Yours, Mine, and Ours?
I've seen bits and pieces of it, just channel surfing, but I have not sat down and watched the whole movie.
It's okay. It's not as good as the first one, but it's not bad at all. We have a question from the chat room. Your siblings, some of them that you're still in contact with, not the Beardsley side, but your mom's side of the family, are all of them in recovery too? Have any of them taken the bad route of being abusive? What's going on with them?
You know, my understanding is that they've all had their own form of therapy along the way, and of course, all of them participated in the family therapy sessions that occurred in 1989. So the path that they've taken is not as clear to me as my own, obviously. But my understanding is that they've been pretty good parents along the way. I mean, I spend time around their children from time to time, and I'm a pretty good read on behavior and attitudes and repressed emotions. And I don't see a lot of that in the children of my North siblings. So one way or another, they've been able to. And I suspect that it has something to do with having been able to experience a loving household in those early formative years.
Yes, I think that was just saving grace of everybody there. Let's get back to transcendental meditation, because I find this absolutely fascinating. Do you feel that everybody can benefit from TM? I do. I think it's a good thing. I think it's healthy.
Absolutely.
Yeah. What do you think?
Well, TM, you know, it's interesting that TM is enjoyed by about 6 million people in the United States today, and there's a wonderful program that is run through the David Lynch Foundation. And David Lynch is a filmmaker who has devoted his life to bringing transcendental meditation to children in urban areas who go to the most troubled schools. And what they've done in Philadelphia, in Washington, D.C., in New York City, in Los Angeles, in San Francisco, is they'll go in and they'll identify the inner city schools that have the worst statistics for academic achievement, and they'll go in and they'll get the parents involved, the administrators and the teachers involved, and they will teach literally thousands of people to meditate, all the students, the faculty, the staff, the parents, if the parents want to, and then they do a before and after statistical analysis, and you know, invariably these schools go to the top of their academic achievement levels, and it's all because they're able to manage stress more effectively in the academic environment. And
absolutely.
My hat is off to David Lynch and the David Lynch Foundation. They've just done wonderful things.
Absolutely, and he's made some dark movies. So to hear that that's where he's focusing his energies is really quite remarkable.
It's really amazing, isn't it? Because you look at films like Blue Velvet that he made.
Disturbing.
It's a weird movie. And yet he himself has been practicing TM for over 40 years. And and he's really quite a remarkable man. So go figure.
And Michael, you have some final questions for Tom North?
Well, I don't know if it's a question as much as just a verification. I came upon meditation through studying Buddhism and yoga, and I found even in stressful situations like traffic, if I have an appointment and I'm running late and it's bumper to bumper and there's nothing I can do about it, when my mind starts to go to that place of, oh, my God, I'm going to be late, blah, 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 if I remember my teachings to just slow down, breathe, do as Thich Nhat Hanh instructs, see the tail lights as eyes blinking at you and just breathe through it, all of a sudden what it takes me from a frantic moment stuck in traffic to a very peaceful, this is beyond my control, I can make it as peaceful as I want or as chaotic as I want, and then slowly there I am inching along with traffic, very content. So it is a powerful, powerful tool, and I'm glad you came upon it.
Yeah, I highly recommend it to everyone. I've never met a person who has not benefited once they began to practice meditation.
Yeah, it would be impossible not to benefit.
Yeah.
And TM can help with other things, too, not just with stress, but if you're trying to quit, it is stressful, if you're trying to quit smoking or lose weight, it can help in many areas of your life, and it's something that you can study and learn, and the good thing is everybody can do it, and it really can truly help.
I have a question,
help.
Trish.
Yes, yes,
what
go
is,
ahead.
Is transcendental meditation different in some way than the meditation I described?
Yes, it's very different, Michael. Transcendental meditation, if you consider the two words, transcendental and meditation, transcendental means to go beyond, and meditation is thought. So during transcendental meditation, you go beyond thought. And the it's a tradition from India, a meditation technique from India, and it involves the use of a sound, which we all know the word mantra, and mantra means a sound whose effects are known. And the great yogis from the tradition of masters in India have passed this down through the generations over the last 5,000 years. And the attention that has been put on the refinement of these sounds that have very specific effects in the physiology to calm the physiology and slow the mind down so that we automatically begin to relax, and stress, if we allow ourselves to relax, stress will automatically be released from the body, from the physiology. So it's very different than the Buddhist techniques of meditation.
Now, so is that like the Om sound?
No, yeah, it's a good question. Interestingly, Om is a reclusive technique. And there are different techniques for householders, which we are all householders, and then there are reclusive people, which would be monks in their caves or in their monasteries, and they use very different sounds. So the sounds that a householder would use would not be an Om. It's just it's a very specific technique for the particular person.
And how do we find out what is our sound?
Well, then you learn that from a TM teacher, and there are thousands of TM teachers. I think if you look in your phone book or if you go to tm.org, you will find that that's the sort of the national TM website. And
well, since I'm reclusive, I'll just stick to Om.
That's perfect. And so tm.org, that's a great place for people to go to get an idea of where they can find a teacher in their area. And there's probably, you could even look up on the internet and get some information if you can't afford any.
And they can go to my website, which is truenorthbytomnorth.com.
Mm-hmm. TrueNorthByTomNorth.com. And you have information there about transcendental meditation. And tell us about your... Pardon me?
There's a link to the TM.org website.
Wonderful. And tell us the name of your book and how people can purchase your book.
So the name, again, is True North, The Shocking Truth About Yours, Mine, and Ours. And it can be purchased on my website, or it can be purchased on Amazon. If you purchase it on my website, 10% of the proceeds of the sale of the book go to CASA, which is the Court-Appointed Special Advocates for Children.
Great
and
organization.
So we are a national sponsor of CASA, and we are actively assisting them in combating domestic violence and child abuse.
That is
so
a fantastic
organization. Great way to contribute to CASA. The what I'd like to share is that I'd like to offer a special savings coupon for your listeners.
Oh, that'd be great.
$5, yeah, to save $5 off of a signed copy.
Mm-hmm.
And so if they will go to the website and use coupon number 118.
118. I'm going to write this down. Okay.
And just say just cite coupon 118. Then we'll send them a signed copy of True North by Tom North,
mm-hmm.
And we'll get that right out.
That sounds
and
wonderful.
And this is at TrueNorthByTomNorth.com?
That's correct.
Okay.
Good deal. And I'll put that link up on my Facebook page, and we'll get it out there. Tom North, I appreciate you sharing some very personal.
I have one last question. I'm so sorry.
That's okay. Go ahead, Michael. We all know and love you. Go for it.
I'm sorry. Tom, was Frank physically or emotionally abusive to Helen, or did they maintain some sort of relationship?
Michael, you have such great questions.
He does, doesn't he?
Oh, thank you.
You know, he was the one person that my mother was the one person he never laid a hand on. And interestingly, there's a chapter in the book called The 25-Cent Solution. And I'll just give you a hint. The 25-Cent Solution refers to 25 cents as the price of a bullet.
Oh,
and if he had
God.
Ever touched my mother, I would have killed him.
Wow, there you go.
So he fortunately never did. But what I would suggest to your listeners, because I know we're running out of time, is that there are ways to take the broken pieces of a life and put
mm-hmm.
them back together. And in the back of the book, we have a resource guide so that if a listener feels that they would like to get help with a particular issue in their lives or many issues in their lives, then there is a resource guide where they can get that guidance and they can get that help they need. It's why I wrote the book. It's one thing to suffer from domestic violence and child abuse. It's another to do something about it. And we can all do something about it. And that's why I wrote the book.
Absolutely, Tom, and I would encourage everybody to pick up your book. It's Tom North and the Truth. Excuse me, everything just went blank on my computer.
Trisha.
Yes, it's Tom North, author of the book True North, The Shocking Truth About Yours, Mine, and Ours. My screen just went totally blank. Sorry about that. And Tom North, thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule for joining us today. We wish you all the best, and we'll probably check in with you again and see how things are going, okay?
Trisha, thank you very much for having me on your show. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much, Tom.
I'm in the process of ordering your
wonderful.
Yeah, I'm in the process of ordering your book as we speak. So
wonderful.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tom. Bye-bye.
Good night now.
Okay, there's that one. Okay, yes, people, that was amazing. No surprise, though, that the Hollywood story was nothing like the real life. But, you know, back in the 60s, people today would be put in prison and their kids taken away for the stuff that went on. Back then, if you called the cops would just tell you to work it out and head home. It wasn't their fault. It was just the way it was. And, that's just so awful. You have to stop the cycle of abuse. That's all there is to it. We do have one more guest. Yes, we do. I told you it was jam-packed. Nobody believes me. We have the wonderful and incredible, if I can get it open here, the wonderful and incredible V.L. Pate. V.L. Pate, how are you today, my dear?
Hi, I'm good. How are you?
Good. Now, you have a blog up, and it has a very interesting true crime story. So I'm going to invite you to tell us a story, but tell us like we don't know anything about the story. So start from the beginning, and first of all, give us the address of your blog, and then start from the beginning of this very interesting story that you're blogging about.
Okay. The address of the blog is www. music.re-newsit.com. Newsit.com.
Okay.
Okay, and I posted the link to the story, to this story, in the chat room.
Oh, okay, great.
On November 2nd, actually November 1st, Renisha McBride, a 19-year-old girl, left her home, according to her family, around 11 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
At about 1 a.m., she was driving recklessly through a neighborhood about maybe 8 miles from her house and crashed into a parked car and a tree. She, according to witnesses, exited her car. She walked off, and about 20 minutes later, they called police. Police designated it as a low priority. And so they hadn't shown up when Renisha, I don't know if I said her name, Renisha McBride, came back to her car. According to some witnesses, she went into her car and out of her car like 3 times. One witness said she looked like she had been bleeding, and they told her they had called the ambulance and the police and just to wait with them, and she said she wanted to go home, and she walked off. One witness said she took a left on a street that would have been about a block away from where the wreck happened.
Mm-hmm.
4 hours later, the police arrive at the scene of the accident. They spend about an hour there. At 2 o'clock in the morning, they finally get the car towed, and nobody ever sees Renisha again. At 4:56 a.m., a man calls police and says he shot someone on his porch and gave his address. Hangs up the phone. The police arrive. It's, of course, Renisha McBride. She's laying with her feet towards the porch and laying on her back. She's been shot in the face by Mr. Theodore Wafer, the homeowner.
Mm-hmm.
And he says his first statement to police, according to media, was that he thought someone was breaking in. It was 4 o'clock in the morning, 4:30 in the morning. He heard noises. He got up to check it out, and then he thought she was breaking in, and his gun accidentally went off.
Mm-hmm.
All of that is not perfectly clear at all. So the prosecutor went ahead and filed charges 2 days ago. It was 13 days after this happened. The prosecutor filed charges. And he's been charged with murder too, manslaughter, and I'm not sure about the gun. The gun is registered to him, but it's like the use of a gun during the commission of a felony, something like
mm-hmm.
that. And she said he shot her through a locked screen door. And another press conference was held by, of course, the family has an attorney. And the
mm-hmm.
attorney said, to be noted, is Renisha's blood alcohol level was twice the legal limit for driving, and for a delinquent, or for a minor, I think it's like 3, it was .218.
Mm-hmm.
And so she could have been, I mean, it's just speculation, but for those 3 hours that she was wandering, she could have been asleep somewhere. I mean, nobody really knows where she was.
Right.
So, anyway, as it stands, no one really knows what happened. And the lawyer for the family says, well, she could have been belligerent, she might have been drunk, she might have been yelling and banging, but that's no reason to shoot her. And, well, it's not, but it does tell you that, you know, as well as I do, that if a defense attorney is going to admit that, it's probably true.
Mm-hmm.
He can admit it. So there's just no telling. But the reason I wanted to come on is because the family stopped talking at the funeral. The family said, we're not going to say anything else. Kim Worthy, the prosecutor, is going to look at filing charges, and we just want to keep a low profile. Did not stop the blog, did not stop the news, did not stop people speculating and turning it into a circus, even though the family said nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So the thing that people are saying is, even the lawyer said she was walking away and he blew her head off. He blew the back of her head off, and
mm-hmm.
she was trying to get away from him, and no one says that. The prosecutor hasn't said that. No one said that.
So they're making up all these bits and pieces to make it sound like it was something horrific, like she was shot leaving the porch, and she was shot in the face, though, right?
She was shot in the face.
Mm-hmm.
And he opened his front door, And he shot her with a shotgun, which I think is like 26 inches long, or I'm not sure. So he opened his door, and he had a, I call it a storm door, they call it a screen door. But there was another door that went out. That door was locked, and he shot through it. Well, he's saying it was an accident. So I don't know if she scared him, you know, like she popped up or whatever, and he accidentally shot it. If you would see the man and his background, he has two DUIs from 20 years ago. That's it. There's nothing else. He did have a stalker that he filed stalking, a restraining order against in 95, and then again 2 months ago in September. So I don't know if he was thinking she was back, you know, or he was just, he could have been trigger happy. I don't know what his deal was, but to make it worse than it is, they turned it around to he was a stalker. He had stalking charges. I saw this tonight. He had stalking charges against him, which is not true. You know, I mean, they're just trying to turn it into racism, that it's race because he's black and he's white. So a lot of the stories you would not believe are that, and this is always what makes me look at the case. This white man saw a black girl on his porch, so he just walked up and blew her head off just because she was black. Okay, that's not going to be true. I mean, it's too ridiculous. But those are the stories that are going around. So.
And so you wanted
to.
So what do you think?
What do you think was the reason for him shooting her? Do you have
any
idea?
I don't know why he shot her. I think he lives alone. He's never, you know, like no one's ever complained. He had a girlfriend in 95 that's talking crap now, but she's the one who's got the stalking charges on. But I don't know. I can't even speculate what happened with him because they've been totally closed-mouthed about it. His lawyers probably said, or given two sentences on what he did. Now, as far as Renisha, his house looked almost exactly like her mother's house, which is 10 miles away. And I have it on my blog. And if you, and they're both on the corner, on the left-hand side, where there's a major cross street in front of them. So I'm thinking, and some other people were talking about this, that maybe she thought she was home. And, you know, a 19-year-old people can't get in their house and they're drunk, they're going to be belligerent. You know,
they're
going to
be
absolutely. And it's going to sound like they're trying to break in.
Yeah.
Yeah, and she could have thought she was home. She still had an alcohol level that was pretty high, so she could have thought, you know, I just want to get in and go to sleep, open the door.
Yeah.
You know.
Wow.
I'm sorry, go ahead, Vicki.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, he had the gun, and he's got to be held responsible for it because I don't agree with turning it around and turning it into this huge racial thing and making it, you know, this big deal where she was running away and he was firing at her and all that baloney. No, let's just keep the facts. But the facts are he had the gun and he shot her, and she was a drunk 19-year-old.
And he was in his house, and someone was trying to gain access. Can you picture yourself in that position, Trisha?
Well,
I'm not a gun owner, so I can't. But
I would just hope that if I was...
We don't know what happened. We don't know if she was trying to pull on the script. I mean, the one, and I'm not defending this man because I don't know what happened. He very well could have seen her and said, "Screw this," you know, and shot her. I don't think so, but I don't know. But I do know Detroit has over one murder a day. Home invasions in that area are constant. Not very long ago, they broke in, tied an elderly – and he lives with his mother that's 81. So I'm sure that was in the back of his head, too, maybe. I don't know that he, you know, someone breaking in with his mother there. But there's so many home invasions, and they have people knock, and they will – go in after, you know, a girl can be standing there and you'll open the door. But at 4:00 in the morning in Detroit, right outside of Detroit, I mean, I think it's different than where I live or where some people live.
Yes.
That you're not, so shy about it or whatever.
I would have been scared.
Yeah, I would have been scared too. And I don't know what happened. I'm just looking at it from the parents' point of view. you know, if that was my kid, I'd be like, why did you overreact? What was she doing? That doesn't give the parents the right to change the story and turn it into something that it isn't. I'm not saying they are. I'm just saying if that happens, that's not right. But I just...
All they have to do is test the forensics on the door and see if
yeah.
her fingerprints are all over the handle or all over
and
the,
see the, direction.
The door
if it was,
face.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if it really was accidental, if he wasn't scared and shot her and then realized. I mean, I don't know. But I hope, Vicki, that people will go to your blog and look at the facts. Let's just keep the facts out there, okay?
Yeah.
There's no need to make anything up. Let's keep the facts. If this guy is proven to be negligent and convicted, then he deserves it. I mean, he did kill this young girl. Yeah, she was 19 and drunk and maybe pounding on this door, but, you know, I don't know what happened. But as a parent looking... Yeah, and trespassing. But as a parent looking at it, I'm like, oh, why did you have to be so extreme? Then again, maybe he had very good reason to be extreme. I don't
right.
know. So
you live in Utah in the middle
I
of
know.
Nowhere. He lives in Detroit.
I know, and he's probably heard
Apples
all these stories that V.L. Pate was talking about home invasions and tying up people, and yeah, that doesn't happen here. So it's really easy for me to get on my high horse and say, well, if I were him, no. But we do just need to stick to the facts, please. And we don't need any more racial upheaval over cases. If they can prove that he shot her because she was black, then, you know, that's a different story. But nowhere is that being shown whatsoever. So let's
well,
just hope
what
that...
I find more what I find more racial than anything is that a case like this gets attention when... There are so many cases, missing people who they don't know who killed them. You know, I mean, there are hundreds of cases and to me, it's just stirring up a pot when you bring attention. This isn't that unusual, really.
Mm-hmm.
And the only reason that it's getting attention is because they wanted to make it racial from the beginning. And even the family said, the lawyers have said, and the prosecutor said during her press conference, it's not about race, you know.
So
it sounds like they look for a story to make it about race.
Right, and it shouldn't be. And it needs to be just the facts, ma'am, please. And Vicki, that's what I like about your blog is you stick to the facts, and that's what we need in cases like this. And, you know, like you said, there's in Detroit alone, there's thousands of cases where every day, like you said, there's a murder every day. It's so violent and so horrible that whole picture needs to be looked at. Why is that happening? What's going on? It's economic, I'm sure a lot of it. But if you focus on one case and try and make it racial where there has not been one iota of evidence to prove that it was racial, that's wrong. So let's just let the case play out. Let's stick to the facts and calm down and talk about it on a rational, real level. Right, everybody?
Yeah.
Everyone agree?
Right.
Good idea. Okay. Michael, do you agree?
I agree completely.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm beat. I'm loopy. I feel like I have a 2.0 liquor level in my blood. I haven't even been drinking. I'm beat. It was a great show tonight, though, wasn't it, Michael?
Oh, I enjoyed every minute of every guest.
I know.
Absolutely.
I could have carried
on with everybody.
Forever and ever and ever.
I thought Michael was hosting.
You actually thought what?
I thought Michael was hosting. I said, I thought Michael was hosting.
Through. Well, he had all the good questions. And
yeah.
See, then people tell me, great show, Tricia. And it's like, I didn't do anything, but hey, everyone gives me the credit. And that's what I live for. So it works out beautifully. Michael,
hey,
you know
should
I
we
appreciate
do a quick, yeah, should
yeah?
we do a quick update on the areas, motions that have been discussed?
Oh, yes, yes. Tell us. You know more about that. Tell us.
Well, Judge Stevens has ruled on the many motions. She has ruled against Jody Arias' petition to get rid of Nurmi, so Nurmi stays. She has granted the defense motion to disallow media coverage. There will be live reporters and one still photographer allowed in the court, but absolutely no live tweeting, no live feeds from the court, nothing from the court. And she has ruled against sequestration, and she has ruled against change of venue.
And why is that? Why do you think?
Well, first, they're going to start, they're hoping to start with jury selection in December. And I don't believe that they'll do a change of venue unless they find it impossible to impanel a juror, an adequate jury that can keep an open mind.
Mm-hmm.
I would think that may be a time when they can revisit it if that's the case. But otherwise, she just saw no reason to grant that.
But
I'm really upset about the motion that they're not going to allow any kind of coverage, because like I've described, I feel like I've invested 5 months in a thriller, and now I'm not going to see the sixth and final chapter of it. You know,
I know, me too.
I want to know how it ends. I guess I'm going to go to Arizona.
That just is like you said, it's like we've, you know, getting to the end of a book and we're taking out the last chapter. And I guess the judge has her reasons. I mean, the Arias case was a circus, but damn, that's all I can say. I'm just as disappointed as you are, Michael, and I don't see it changing. So I think we're stuck with, thank goodness for people like Beth Karras. Hopefully she'll be there, and she's the best reporter at doing this, at running out and telling us what happened.
I don't think she will, though.
Oh,
I don't
know.
Don't
tell me that.
She doesn't have, well, she doesn't have press credentials,
uh-huh.
So she can't get in on that. And Sky and I were actually talking about this earlier. I don't know if, because it won't be covered by the media, if it will go ahead quietly. If you recall, there was a circus atmosphere during the last trial where the line started at like 3 or 4 in the morning outside of the courthouse. I don't know if that'll be the case for the sentencing phase, now that it's not getting the media attention. I don't know, but as far as Beth, you know, HLN used to pay all her travel expenses, and now everything would have to come out of pocket, and I don't believe Wild About Trials can probably have the deep pockets to send someone there. I just don't know.
We'll have to wait
unless,
and see.
Unless someone like CNN were to contract with her to go. She hasn't mentioned anything about it to me, so I don't know.
Well, we'll keep our fingers crossed, and if we can't get Beth Harris, let's hope we can get somebody down at the area sentencing trial, and it will be a mini-trial. Let's hope we can get somebody down there that can do the good reporting, go in, and then come out and report to everybody. It will happen. There will be people. There will be people from Nancy Grace's show. I mean, we'll get a good idea of what's going on, but it's just not going to be the same. So I guess, Michael, we'll just have to wait for firsthand reports. That's all I can say. Very disappointing, but let's just hope for some sort of finality. If the jury comes up again and they're unable to reach a decision on if she gets death or life, then doesn't it automatically revert to life now?
Yes. Well,
yeah,
no.
So,
I mean, the judge ultimately gets to decide.
Oh, okay.
But, I think, and like I've, all of us who have spoken privately, Sky, the family, whatever, you know, Judge Stevens is aware of everything that wasn't allowed in the trial. She knows a lot more than most than the jurors ever knew, and
that
we, the public, know. And so I cannot see her offering her anything but life. She just is very aware of the guilt and the machinations of this woman. So,
Exactly. Let's go one more time. I think you're absolutely right. One more time to VLPate, give us that address again of your blog, please.
www.re-newsit.com.
re-newsit.com, www.re-newsit.com. VLP, thank you so much for coming on, my dear. I do appreciate it. You take care now,
you're
okay?
Welcome. Bye-bye.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
And, Michael, thank you for sticking with us. It's almost a three-hour show here. I am beat. I feel like I've been in the ring. I'm gonna go eat Mexican food. That's the only thing that helps me through this. I'm just gonna go pile on the cheese. Ooh, that sounds good. What are you gonna do, Michael?
I too am going to eat something and curl up and watch my Sunday night television.
All right, that sounds great. And I want to thank everybody who came into the chat room today. We really appreciate it. We're going to have another great show next Sunday. It's Trisha's True Crime Radio. Oh, I almost forgot. We do need to be gooed again before we go. Let me pull up the goo here
twice?
One more time. What we do, I do goo. I goo in the first and goo at the end. I want to make sure we are sufficiently gooed legally. And here it is. Trisha's True Crime Radio. The opinions expressed on the shows are those of the hosts and guests, and they are completely separate from WebSleuth.com LLC and ForumsForJustice.org. So if you get upset at something you hear on this show, you don't take it out on the websites, my darlings. You come to me. I'm the Trisha and Trisha's True Crime Radio, and we'll make you happy. It's Trisha's True Crime Radio, where we discuss current events and true crime, and we always do it with common sense. Good night, everyone.
Good night, Trisha.
Good night.